Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. We got a pretty busy agenda, and I'm going to hope to just keep moving quickly today. I want to start the day by inviting the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education to come forward. Today is MACD Day, and I've had the privilege of working with this group for the past several years. And we haven't had an opportunity to hear from them this year, and I thought we'd extend that opportunity on MACD Day. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Mike Miller. I'm the Dean of the College of Education at Minnesota State Mankato, and I'm here representing MACD, the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. This is our first MACD Day on the Hill, and so we're going to be seeing you in your offices in all likelihood, and so welcome, and we're certainly happy to be here. I have three handouts that have been distributed to you. The first is a MACD brochure, and you'll find in that brochure that there are 29 approved teacher education colleges and universities in Minnesota. We care deeply about the preparation of teachers and have a wide range of programs, and advocate for high standards for teachers as well as strong programs for our children and families and communities. The second handout is a brief listing of a few of our legislative priorities. For those of you in your offices who will be meeting with us, we'll be talking about some of those priorities and others, but again, you'll find that some of those have to do with teacher preparation and many of those have to do with education of children, something that we're deeply engaged with. I think I'd like to mention that this year particularly we've been in conversation and partnership with a variety of community groups and professional education groups and advocating for E16 kinds of policies and procedures and really want to advance how our state is doing in its entirety and wanting to be responsive as a profession to that particular call. The last handout is a purple and gold handout, and it's from Minnesota State Mankato. And this is an example. What I'd like to encourage you to understand about us is that all of our institutions are working very closely with communities and schools and policymakers and others to try to find the right answers and do the right thing. Your committee and others have heard from researchers and teacher educators from the University of Minnesota and others. This is an example of 3 years of work from Minnesota State Mankato with area school districts, other teacher preparation institutions to try to solve, to try to find answers how to meet the needs of children who don't speak English in small, medium-sized, and large numbers in our school districts in South Central Minnesota. So this is an example of the kind of work that we're doing. So please understand, we prepare teachers, principals, and counselors. We also are involved in professional development, and we also are deeply engaged in learning communities to try to find the right answers. I would offer our services and our knowledge and our energies to answer anything that questions that you have. If there are things that we can help with, we're here to do that. And so that's the message that I want to leave you with.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. And members, I would encourage you to take Mr. Miller up on his offer. I have had the privilege of working with this group over the last few years, spoke at your annual gathering this last fall, and you've been very helpful in working with authors and the chair and some of the induction proposals that we've had before us to date. And you represent a very broad, geographically broad, but also institutionally broad, very inclusive group of professionals who are working to enhance the caliber of our teaching cadre here in Minnesota. So thank you very much
for
being with us today.
Have a wonderful day.
Members, the first bill for today is House File 796. Representative Murphy, welcome. I think this is your first foray into our committee. It's a privilege to have you here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, the chair will move House File 796. Chair will move House File 796 be recommended to pass. and re-refer to the Finance Committee, and our recommendation to them is that they re-refer to the Early Childhood Finance Committee. So welcome, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Thank you.
And read us Goodnight Moon. It's one of my favorite books. I actually have memorized it.
We knew that. My name is Erin Murphy, representative from St. Paul. And Mr. Chair and members, I am delighted to be here for my first visit to E-12 education and happy to bring before you House File 796, which provides grants from the Department of Human Services for training in family, friend, and neighbor child care. Family, friend, and neighbor child care, also known as legally unlicensed care, is the oldest and most common form of child care in Minnesota. Passage of this legislation will put Minnesota at the leading edge of the nation in efforts to improve training opportunities for quality in family, friend, and neighbor child care. Family, friend, and neighbor caregivers could include a child's aunt, grandparents, a neighbor down the street, a close friend, or a cousin, like I used when my kids were 2 and 3 years old. 70% of Minnesota families use some form of informal care on a regular basis. 46% use family, friend, and neighbor care as their primary child care arrangement, and 24% of families use it exclusively. Family, friend, and neighbor providers generally have less training than their counterparts in center and licensed family child care, with less than 20% having any formal early childhood teaching experiences. This bill will provide additional training opportunities for family, friend, and neighbor providers in an effort to improve the quality of the experience for children, families, and providers. It's a voluntary program. It's a grant program. I think it's worth your scrutiny. I have with me Gretchen Ranka, the Youth Services and Outreach Coordinator for the Hennepin County Library System, and Samira Bilal, Robbie, I told her I would butcher her name this morning, the Executive Director of the Early Child Resource and Training Center. They have expertise in this issue, and they would like to testify. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And before we hear testimony, I understand you have an oral amendment that you would wish the mover of the motion to make. And
Thank you.
So why don't we deal with that, and then we'll get into the testimony.
Yes, we need to change the years. On page 2, I believe, lines 3.9 and 3.10, change the years from 2007 and 2008 to 2008 and 2009.
Okay, give me a second. I'm not finding it.
Page 3.
Page 3 on line 3.6. We're going to change that first year, fiscal year 2007 to 2008. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then the 2008 later on changes to 2009 on that same line? Okay, if that's your desire, the chair will move that amendment. Need discussion? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is before us the way you wish it to be. And who do you wish to, Ms. Bilal Robi? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and give us your testimony. Good morning.
Thank you. My name is Samira Bilal Robi, and that's okay that she butchered it. I'm the Executive Director of Early Childhood Resource and Training Center. We have been in existence since 1973, and our main goal is to really work with FFN, the non-traditional learners. What we do is we bring them in at an entry level. We start with English language learning, then we take them through the quality training. The quality training is anywhere from infant, toddler, special needs, how to be a provider, and many more topics, and we design them for the community. We mainly work with new immigrants and communities that really work with children who are underrepresented, you know, the families. Our intention is to take them from entry to college, and success stories have been that we have had new immigrants now, especially I'm speaking about the Latino, the Somali community, we've had the Native community. We even have providers who begin with us and leave and go back to their country and do their training online with us. So we really know the need, have had experience working with providing these services to FFN. And I want to stress that how important FFN is. I am a grandmother of nine. I have been in this field for over 30 years, and I also do FFN at times. So I'm going to end right there, make it short and sweet.
Thank you, Ms. Vilarobi. And Ms. Gretchen Ranka, is that correct? Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gretchen Ranka. I'm the Youth Services and Outreach Coordinator for the Hennepin County Library System. And I'd like to tell you this morning that Minnesota's librarians are ready for this legislation. In 2005 and 2006, librarians across the state participated in intensive training funded by a federal grant to the State Library Agency. We learned how to incorporate the six skills that children need to learn before they start school to become successful readers into our traditional programs like preschool story times. Accessing the grant funds available in House File 796, Sections 2.20 to 2.28, is going to allow librarians to go a step further in our partnership with providers and the organizations working with them. We're primed to use an early literacy model training curriculum developed for parents and caregivers that's available in both Spanish and English. This curriculum is based on research by the National Institutes of Child Health and Development. It was adapted for use by librarians by Dr. Grover Whitehurst and Dr. Christopher Lonigan, who are eminent early literacy researchers. Minneapolis Public Library and Hennepin County Public Library were among 14 libraries across the country invited to participate in a pilot project to test out the tools developed by Lonigan and Whitehurst. The audience for this pilot in Hennepin County Library were child care providers and children receiving our children's Readmobile service. And Mr. Chair, I remember the day you came on the Readmobile when it was parked out in front of the Capitol, and we had a good conversation about its work with providers. Hennepin County Library's outcomes in this pilot project mirrored what went on across the rest of the country. In an evaluation funded by the Public Library Association and the Association for Library Service to Children, which are divisions of the American Library Association, the results indicated that these librarian-presented workshops did help caregivers become more effective first teachers by incorporating the needed skill-building activities into their daily routine with the preschoolers. This legislation will also enable libraries to provide more beautifully written and well-illustrated books reflecting the ethnic, racial, and language diversity of the state that could be easily enjoyed by Minnesota's children and caregivers. Providing school readiness opportunities for children and quality training for their caregivers who live in remote areas is another priority in this legislation. On the White Earth Reservation, a children's Readmobile early literacy and learning readiness service is just about ready to go on the road. It's going to make regular visits to family, friend, and neighbor providers on the reservation. This legislation would provide the opportunity for Whitehurst to expand and enhance this service and replicate it on other reservations and areas of the state. House File 796 is sensible, practical public policy. Your public libraries are already community gathering places. They serve families and caregivers. As librarians and our partners in child care take advantage of these proposed grants, we'll be able to expand and enhance the early literacy and school readiness opportunities that we're already providing in your communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ranka. Are there any questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Murphy, why do you think this bill is necessary? Because parents typically have the responsibilities to do this as well as choose their own daycare providers, et cetera. Why would you want this kind of control from the government?
Representative
Murphy. Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I guess I don't view this as control from the government, but giving parents options to choose higher quality child care providers. It's a, Representative Erickson, it's a voluntary program. 70% of families have their children in family, friend, and neighbor child care providers arrangements. And I believe that this will allow providers the opportunity to learn and connect and provide a better quality of provide better quality care for the children that are coming to their family home. And that's just an option that improves the situation for families.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, don't care providers already have networks?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, they may. They do. And this is just an opportunity to improve those networks.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I actually have sort of a comment more to the committee. Mr. Chair, we're going to have several early literacy bills traveling through, and I hope we can look at all of them, members. I think this one's really interesting because it deals with family, friend, and provider caregivers and helping them. I mean, and that this is an area we don't have. There are also going to be a couple through Head Start and early literacy. So I'm not sure everybody else is looking at it, but I'm hoping we can look at early literacy programs and kind of see what's happening with them and how these bills fit in and make kind of a comprehensive decision. So that's my comment.
Well, and Chair Slawick, my understanding is that as I look at this bill, that it creates opportunities for those who are in the unlicensed care. And the state has, I think, a very unique blend of licensed and unlicensed care. When I first found out about it, I got really worried about it and then realized that, you know, Minnesota, to a large degree, makes both of those happen very effectively. We provide opportunities for unlicensed daycare centers to have access to training opportunities, to enhancements, and be connected, and it seems to work fairly well in our state. Representative Bentwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would caution members about these kinds of bills if we're going to be hearing more of them. We are going to have to make some tough decisions about funding eventually, and I realize this is a policy committee, but as we pick and choose what we're going to focus our energies on, I guess I share some of Representative Erickson's concerns about these kinds of bills, that they are reaching into an area. If we're going to take the state and focus our resources on making the greatest impact, is this the kind of bill we should be supporting? Yes, it's nice to add additional money. If the state could throw money at private organizations of all kinds doing all kinds of things in our communities, maybe they'd all, the whole community would be better. But I seriously question whether this is the role of the state, getting in the midst of these provider networks that, by their very nature, are private and dealt with in a private way. I know this myself. I have five kids. Some of you saw them on the floor of the house yesterday. We find family, friends, and neighbor providers for our children, and I don't know that we need the state buying books or providing training to those people. They do a wonderful job. Maybe you could respond to that, Representative Murphy.
Senator Gutlaw, you did a wonderful job of with your children on the floor, too. Typically, with that many kids, we wouldn't be able to hear each other. Representative Murphy or testifiers, any? Ms. Vanka.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to respond to that, Representative. Family, friend, and neighbor child care providers are already relying heavily on the resources of local public libraries. That is the place in the communities where they come to get the books that they need to use with the children in their care. This legislation would help public libraries provide even more books and better services. Often a family, friend, and neighbor provider wants to bring a group of children to a library story time, and because of registration or space of the meeting room, they are unable to accommodate it. So this is an efficient way of enhancing the role of the public library in the early literacy infrastructure.
Representative Gutlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only response to that, and I'm married to a librarian, so I know what of I speak. We have the Great River Regional Library in central Minnesota, for example. Shouldn't this be a library funding bill then? You know, library resources are a constant issue. I know our community puts a lot of support behind them, but
Mr. Chair, Representative, Minnesota libraries are thrilled that that we were invited to provide some language into this legislation because we believe that libraries are integrated into all aspects of children's school readiness and early literacy, that we're not just a separate entity in a community that isn't part of everything else. We think this is a model way.
Ms. Bilal-Roby.
Thank you. I want to just respond to resources. I also want to respond to disparities. FFN providers in a lot of the rural areas and in our local areas do not have the resources that some others may have. The funding that is in the bill is for transportation, would be possibly transportation to the library. We have found that our providers, our FFM providers, make about $2.50 an hour when you break it down. The resources that this bill would give would be for those who don't have a lot of advantages that some others may. Now, I, as an FFM, I'm able to give my grandchildren, I have resources to give them. But a lot of my clients do not have the resources to pay for training. And this really is about a safety net for quality for our children. And so, again, I want to stress that this is not about control. This is about, let me say one more thing. I am I was born in Minnesota. I am a grandmother. I'm just going to tell you I'm over 50. So I know the history of Minnesota. I know how the demographics have changed. And it looks very, very different. And I think as Minnesotans that we have to really invest in our providers and our children and look at those who don't have the resources. I understand what you're saying. I think I'm not the typical grandmother. I'm a very good grandmother, but I know very many grandmothers that are isolated. Children are sitting, possibly watching television, learning English through the television. And I want to put a positive note on that. But we as entities that can go into the home with home visiting, transportation, taking them to the library, that's a whole different picture. So I would just urge you to look at that picture.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I wanted to respond a little to Representative Gottwald's point. You know, about 4 years ago, Governor Pawlenty came to District 60, my Senate district, with I think then Secretary of Education, and they were announcing a grant, I think whose goals were somewhat similar to this. It was I think at the time the governor was touting a everyone should read by first grade initiative. I'm not sure kind of what happened to that, but the announcement was of a federal grant to help in this, you know, kind of a community-based effort. I think at this point it was to train teachers to help in early literacy. And so I think there is a role for the state and, in this case, the federal government in assisting these kinds of initiatives. And so there's certainly, I think, some bipartisan consensus around that, at least in the past. And I'm especially pleased that you're using this for transportation because we've seen in some hearings we've done in the Transportation Committee that a lot of opportunities are missed because of the lack of transportation, both in terms of education and, you know, career and professional development. So I really applaud your efforts, and I do believe there is a role for the public sector in supporting these kinds of initiatives.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? If not, Representative Murphy, any closing words for us? I have some for you. In the great green room, there was a telephone and a red balloon and three bears sitting on chairs.
You don't even need the book. With that, Mr. Chair, I will say thank you to you and the members of the committee, and I hope for your support.
Members, the chair renews his motion that House File 796, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. And our recommendation would be that that be re-referred to Early Childhood Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Murphy and Ms. Bilal-Roby and Ms. Rocca. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have House File 1089, Representative Peterson. There is a delete all to this bill, and that is being passed out at the present moment. Peterson, would you move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would first of all like to move House File 1089 to
be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
To be passed and referred to Finance Committee. And then I would like to move a delete all amendment. And it is H1089DE1. You should have it in front of you. It's just being passed out now.
We'll give our members a second to get that, and perhaps, Representative Peterson, you can describe what the delete all amendment does to the original bill, and then we'll get onto the bill.
Actually, it divides the bill that you will be hearing from me versus Representative Bly. It takes out one component of the professional development. And this is really important. You know, I've been carrying a lot of the professional development bills because I'm very passionate about this issue. It's one which is so important, not only in the K-12 system, but also in the area of early childhood. We know that providers of early education also need the ability to be able to provide for their clients in a way that makes some sense, and that is that they get professional development, that they begin to provide the kind of curriculum early on that prepares our children for school. And so this really talks about, this is kind of a framework or a system for early childhood professional development, and it provides a consistent continuum of opportunities to increase the professional development of early childhood providers. And it also implements the quality rating system so that parents will have a better idea of what is a quality program for them to choose. And it does expand the quality rating system currently being done by the MELF Foundation. And it would offer more geographic opportunities and diversity to the outcome data from the current pilots. In other words, they could expand those pilots that the MELF Foundation is already operating with. I think it is a system that is very effective, and at least the proposal looks very effective, and we have three testifiers here who I think can talk to this issue much more effectively than me. So with that, I'm going to let them introduce themselves and talk to this issue.
Representative Peterson, let's make sure we have your amendment acted on so then we can then proceed with the bill as you want it before us. The members, the amendment that essentially takes out the original Section 2 of the original bill, which is the TEACH component, and later on we're going to hear from Representative Bly, who has that same language in his bill. And so this essentially shapes this bill up the way you want it to be acted on today. With that, members, Representative Peterson moves the DE1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is before us in the way you want it to be before us. And so let's hear from your testifiers. Welcome, and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Kainer-Ross, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. Child Care Works is a statewide coalition of parents, child care providers, and children's advocates, all working together to achieve affordable, quality child care for families who need it in Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity today to testify in the bill and appreciate Representative Peterson's efforts for bringing this forward. In the child care field, we talk about the three legs of child care that make it work for families who need it. The three legs are quality, affordability, and access. If those three legs are strong, families can depend on this tool when they need it. If even one of the legs is weak, the stool's functionality is in question. And so it is with childcare. When childcare is at its full potential, a high-quality yet affordable setting with loving, well-trained caregivers operating in a partnership with parents, we see children thrive and they arrive on the kindergarten doorstep ready to succeed. The bill before you, House File 1089, is one of the quality legs of our three-legged stool and is an extremely important component in ensuring that childcare providers are well-equipped to operate at full potential. House File 1089 addresses a number of things all surrounding the quality of childcare. It includes a structure for the professional development of childcare providers. It allows funds to help providers become licensed and accredited. And it expands the quality rating system pilots that are currently being rolled out by the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. The Departments of Human Services and Education just released a report based on a series of focus groups done with parents late last year regarding what was important to them in their childcare setting. The characteristic of highest importance to parents in the focus group was the caregiver's training and experience. So I'd suggest that although the proposals in this bill are highly based on research, that there also is qualitative data that shows us that this is the direction that parents want the state to pursue. And with that, I'll turn the mic over to Dr. Catherine Tout to talk a little bit about quality and professional development.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Tout. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Tout, and I'm a researcher and evaluator at Child Trends, and I study programs and policies in early care and education. I've conducted a number of studies examining child care quality in Minnesota, and I'm also evaluating currently two large professional development evaluations looking at what kinds of strategies are effective for early childhood educators. And I wanted to just take a moment here today to talk about the very strong research base that links quality to child outcomes, but also links professional development to quality. This is well established in the research literature, and in fact, two panels, both convened by the National Academy of Sciences, have drawn the conclusion that quality and children's outcomes are linked, with one panel describing high quality is related to all the outcomes that parents and society hope to see in their children, ranging from cooperation with adults to the ability to initiate and sustain positive peer relationships and friendships to early competence in reading and math. What creates quality environments and interactions? So going back to that panel of experts, the thing that is most central is the knowledge and skills of teachers or caregivers. That's the most important predictor of quality in children's environments. Professional development, which can include formal education, it can include community training, it can include participation in a program to gain professional credentials, such as the Child Development Associate. All of those are key determinants of a teacher's or caregiver's knowledge or skills. And when we look at what specific facets of the quality are linked to professional development and what impact do they have on child outcomes, well, we know that professional development is linked to higher levels of global quality measured by objective observations. And this can include the health and safety of the environment, the materials and activities available to the children, the pacing and structure of the day, and the interactions that children have with teachers and caregivers and with each other. Children can thrive in a safe and healthy environment with a variety of activities and materials that can help them develop social skills, encourage creative expression, language, thinking and reasoning, and can foster a positive identity. And this global quality then is in turn linked to these positive child outcomes such as language and literacy and social competence. And then moving beyond the global quality to the specific interactions that teachers and caregivers have with children, this research also shows that teacher or caregiver sensitivity is strongly linked to professional development status. So those educators who have higher levels of professional qualifications are better able to respond warmly and appropriately to children, tailor their responses to the developmental needs of the child, and they also provide a higher quality verbal and cognitive stimulation and attention and emotional support to children. So professional development status is also linked to the quality of language used with children and the ability to positively manage classroom behavior and dynamics. So these two links, this link between professional development and quality and the link between quality and child outcomes, has a very strong basis in the research literature. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tout. Ms. Stoll, Kim Stoll, is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kim Stoll. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1089. In my capacity as a grants administrator at Resources for Child Caring, I work closely with the Child Care Services Grants. Child Care Services Grants are grants that are available to licensed child care providers, centers, after-school programs, legally exempt child care providers, and family, friend, and neighbor providers. The grants are available on a statewide basis, and the funding is allocated to each region. Each region has a local grants advisory committee that helps determine the priorities for the region. The grants are then awarded based on the identified priorities for things like items, equipment, and training to increase the quality of care in these programs. The child care services grants that have been funded by Resources for Child Caring focus on meeting priorities identified in each of the metro counties. These grants include a multicultural component, which focuses on integrating diversity into child care and serving diverse communities. Typical requests on a grant application include things such as egress windows, fences, books, educational toys, training, computers, and outdoor equipment. The amount of funding that can be requested with these grants ranges from $500 to $10,000. The amount of funding allocated to child care providers in the metro area for this fiscal year was able to fund approximately 406 programs out of approximately 6,000 programs total. Additional funding would provide the opportunity for more programs and children to be impacted. Throughout the fiscal year, we received inquiries about requests for additional funding and are unable to meet that need. Child care providers who received a grant have shared their thoughts on the benefits of the grants program. One child care provider stated, "It made me more aware and accountable to the many possibilities of the educational activities I can do with the children. The grant has also rejuvenated my spirit and love for teaching by giving me an opportunity to purchase excellent resources and tools that make teaching more fun. Among other things, the process of applying and writing this grant taught me that I can do anything I put my mind to doing. I feel like a more experienced, knowledgeable, and capable person, which in turn helps me to be and feel like a better provider."
Thank you, Ms. Stahl. Are there questions? Representative Erickson and Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Again, Representative Peterson, I have the question, why do we need this? I know we might want it, or some might want it, but why do we need this? I don't think child care is in a crisis. When I was knocking on doors, my child care provider said, just leave us alone. And they do wonderful work throughout rural Minnesota, I know. Are we in some kind of crisis? Why do we need this?
Well,
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, once again, and one of the things here that's interesting, which I didn't know, there are 19 regional centers. And there may be some daycare providers who feel very comfortable with their knowledge and skills, and they wouldn't even take advantage of this. They would not work with those community providers. However, I know a number of daycare providers who want the kind of advantages that are offered in a professional development program like this. They want to have the opportunity to know, what is a good curriculum that I can use with my young with the children? How can I interact more effectively? How do I get together and talk about some of the problems and some of the issues that I might confront as a daycare provider? I mean, this is not an easy job to have, what, 6 to 10 maybe young children varying ages in your home or in a private setting, and to have them all day to deal with the issues, it's not any different than a classroom teacher who has to confront those kinds of issues on a daily basis. Now, if this is not infringing on those people who feel very comfortable, it's not mandatory, but it is providing an additional opportunity to provide good, solid daycare for those providers who need more information, and I think thus prepares our children more for school, so, and for readiness.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Peterson, on page 3, in lines 310 through 312, why does the commissioner have to seek the input of a labor union when deciding on the 2-hour early childhood training for new child care practitioners? Why is that needed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, actually, some of the daycare providers are represented as a group. by a union, and they have a relationship with the county already, and so this would be an opportunity to coordinate some of those ideas and work with them.
Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, you know, with all due respect to the research, and I know we're all trying to accomplish good things for early childhood education. There's no question about that. We want the best for our kids when they're young. But child care providers, and I'm somewhat familiar with this field myself, are in fact a private business. The challenges of being a child care provider are well known to the ones that I know. And we're talking now about creating a state-funded program to start providing grants and standards and quality measurements to go into a private business, into the private sector, and start helping that private sector do things they're already doing. There are private areas for people to go for additional development and additional enrichment, and many child care providers take advantage of those opportunities. And while I would agree there are some who are maybe struggling, some that aren't so good, it's incumbent on parents to evaluate a child care provider and decide if they're the right child care provider for their kids. We're talking about creating here the beginnings of a public education program for child care. And I really question whether that's the appropriate role of the state. Don't we have other priorities on which to focus our resources as a state, appropriate state role? It builds a little on Representative Erickson's comments, but as I listen to the research, there's no doubt that good child care providers create good outcomes. The question is, does the state need to be doing the things listed in this bill? Expanded quality rating system, child care services grants, early childhood professional development, into the realm of a private provider in a private sector. When parents have children, they take on the responsibility for raising those kids. And so we, I know for my part, make the decision about where I'm going to put my kid or kids in daycare. And I evaluate the provider, and I evaluate what they're doing or what they aren't doing, and then I put my money there. And if they need additional development, sometimes they say, we need more money for that. So again, why is it the state's job to do these things in the private sector?
Representative Peters.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, when we're talking about quality rating systems, we're also connecting to the MELF or the private sector foundation, which has been established to begin dealing with providing information about what are quality places for young children to attend during their hours during the day. And this would provide daycare providers the opportunity to get the kind of education that they would need to get a high rating in this quality rating system. And I think that would be something that we would want to have for our available for our providers. Again, it's not mandatory, but many of our providers don't know where to turn or where to go for that information, nor are those opportunities always available. But I'm going to ask if you are, Ann, do you have any additional comments on this?
Ms. Kateroth.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think one of the pieces that is important to point out, again, Representative Peterson did speak to the voluntary nature of this. But in terms of the professional development system that's laid out here, what this really does is take pieces that are already in place that the state is already involved in and tries to streamline them in a way that providers can see a career lattice, can see a way to build upon the trainings that are required of them if they so choose to really build their knowledge base and their education around early childhood development. I think the point that we would make in terms of the state's role here is, yes, indeed, this absolutely is a private market, and all child cares are essentially private businesses. They also are typically extremely low paid in terms of business owners. Some may be less so. Generally speaking, across the state and nationwide, child care providers, particularly family child care providers and workers in centers, are extremely low paid. And it seems like there is an argument to be made that the type of care provided to very young children will impact the state as those children move along in society in terms of their impact into the K-12 system, into the juvenile justice system, et cetera, and if it is possible to provide those children with a good quality early education, that we might be able to provide those children with a better road to travel upon, so to speak. And so that's, I think, part of the intent behind this bill. Again, entirely voluntary for providers to take part in this training system as laid out, certainly voluntary in terms of the child care services grants, but these are services that have been found so far in the state to be useful for providers.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions. Representative Peterson and testifiers, I'm sensitive to child care discussions my whole 9 years and have learned a lot about the differences and the different kinds of systems. When it comes to centers, I think nobody argues this is it's good to train them and the development opportunities are important. It appears this is also applied to the licensed homes and the legal unlicensed as well. Is that correct?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
I have a couple of questions. And so that's a whole different animal when you start getting involved in the licensed home and the legal unlicensed. The legal unlicensed have hardly any this is a whole new step when you go to that category of services. We discussed last year in the bill I carried some training and for the licensed homes, and that was controversial, just so you know. And I want to caution members and maybe the author, too, to, as you read the new language, which I'm just reading today for the first time since it's a delete-all, the commissioner shall develop and phase in this system. It doesn't really say it's voluntary. It doesn't really say how are they going to develop it. It doesn't say is it by a rule. It doesn't say that there's a process by which people can come. It doesn't ask for legislative approval of the phase. And it gives her, at this point, a blanket freedom to develop pretty much anything they want as long as it meets these criteria. And it's going to apply to everybody. And if she decides that they want 16 hours of training a year for a legal and licensed home, that could be phased in under the language that you have here. So I want to caution you as you move with this that even though you're calling it voluntary, she could say that it's not voluntary because you're silent on the fact that it's voluntary or not. And so that means in the phase in the development that they can do, they can make it say anything. And we already have Rule 2 and Rule 3, which is well gone through processes, and when there's a change, it's really controversial. And so I just want to caution as you advance with this, what you have is a very open-ended, very broad-reaching thing, possibly. And so we discussed, I think, last week, a matter where the department would, without rulemaking, make rules or make policies. And I think that's a concern as this moves forward. And I have another question as well.
Representative Abel, I think it's a good caution. I think Representative Peterson would like to comment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, this is not for unlicensed. I clarify that. This is only for licensed daycare providers, first of all. And this is already a program that is in place that basically just expands the program slightly, and it does say grants. To me, when you say grants, that is people who apply, and the commissioner or whomever will give the grants to these providers, and certainly with these 19 regional community areas. Now, if that's not clear enough, we can certainly clarify that. But this is only for licensed daycare.
Part of our job as a policy committee is to be clear about the scope and intent here. Representative Abel.
Mr. Chair, and maybe as this moves, is this going to early childhood next?
Representative Abel, I think that is the intent.
Well, they're very capable of working it. But I think if you mean it to be voluntary and you mean it to be whoever wants to can come, then I think you want to work on language that says that. Because it depends who's in charge of a department, how things go. And you know yourself, working with departments, not just this one, that it really depends who's running that little sub-department, how things are interpreted. And you've spent time on your own watch haggling with people over rules that were pretty clear that they didn't agree with you about how clear they were. And then the final thing, Mr. Chair, is I imagine there'd be some cost to the department to do this. Whenever I have them do a study, they charge me a lot of money. And I hope the department can weigh in on what they think they'll need for this to appropriate it, and that if this is going to go forward, that the author wouldn't get caught short by funding requests, that they'll say, this is about a $100,000 project. I if they want to do it, it's 50,000 and so on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and to the testifiers. I just have a couple quick comments. One, this is a new path for these bills. As we know, usually they go through Health and Human Services, because ultimately the early childhood bill is split into both of those areas, and that's more where this is funded. So it's new having this before this committee and a new process. So I just want to acknowledge that, first of all. The real goal, and those of you that are on the Early Childhood Committee know that what we're trying to do with young children is we're trying to close the achievement gap, and we're trying to improve quality. Those are two of our three initiatives in our area. The other is to get citizens involved. If we want to do well in this committee and have our third graders test well, we have got to look at what's going on in child cares. The governor knows that. He's proposed an initiative around that. He's involved with looking at quality in terms of proposing a scholarship system. Quality matters. Quality is how you make the difference in how kids are going to be ready for kindergarten and ready for school. And the single most important indicator of quality is that adult that is with these kids. And that's what this bill looks at. So philosophically, I want to say it's a good bill. Appreciate you bringing it forward. Obviously, it might be a little bit more work to do in terms of making it palatable, but I think, members, we need to remember, too, that there is a place for child care, and we in our committee have talked about we're not interested in changing into a public, you know, we're not having universal preschool, or, you know, we want the private system to be private, but we want to support these families and support these providers in having a quality experience for our youngest children, because that's the way we're, you all are going to save money in K-12 and the folks that are they're involved in that system. So I just hope we can see things move forward in terms of this bill, and I think it's an important bill for moving kids and child care forward.
Thank you, Representative Slawick. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I've got a question. Subdivision 2 at line 3.5, the two-hour early childhood training section. The wording, by January 15th, the commissioner, with input from these organizations, shall identify new training that meets the two-hour requirement with input from these councils, and also seek input from labor unions to serve family care providers if the union is recognized by a county. Could you explain what your intent is, Representative Peterson, with identifying new training and consulting with these organizations and also with the labor union?
Mr. Speaker Mariani and Representative Demmer. First of all, this two-hour childhood training is for new daycare situations that arise, and I think we certainly want to have new training for or training for those folks as they begin this process of setting up a new daycare setting. And this would require that they have 2 hours. That's not very much training, actually, when you think about it. But this would offer those practitioners 2 hours of training. And then for the talking about the commissioner, if we have a labor union that serves all of the daycare providers or as part, it represents all the daycare providers in that area, those representatives then would be involved in determining at least having some input in the kind of training that would be provided for practitioners. And do you want to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, I do just want to clarify that the two-hour training in early childhood development is something that's already required in the statute of new providers. The only thing that changes here is to look at some continuity among counties in terms of the types of trainings that are, in fact, qualified for that 2 hours of training. That's why there is a list here of different entities that would get together and essentially create this list of trainings that meet some criteria of early childhood development that is already required.
Representative Dabney.
Good morning. Thank you.
Morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. It's an issue. This is an issue much on my mind, both this and the Bly bill, perhaps because it 9:30, I'm supposed to be touring a possible preschool setting for my youngest.
We'll hope to get to that.
I'm not confident, Mr. Chair. But
members, by the way, we will adjourn promptly at 9:30. A recess, rather, is the proper. We'll be recessing promptly at 9:30, and we'll reconvene at 6 p.m. to take up the rest of the bills before us. Representative.
I guess my personal life is intruding on my policy life here, or vice versa. I'm not sure which. But it does make me reflect on the quality rating system portion of the bill. And I know as I walk into that preschool today, I like to think that I'm better prepared than the average bear on looking at that, and evaluating what's the quality of that care setting. And we're very pleased with the quality of the daycare setting we're at now. It's in a basement, has benefited from a lot of professional development across the highway at St. Paul Technical College, or whatever they're calling themselves these days. And we can see the impact when she comes back from classes, and better outreach to the parents, changes in the curriculum there, and that sort of thing. But I also know that, you know, we ended up there because, yeah, we'd heard good things in the neighborhood about them, and they were convenient. And so kind of word of mouth and convenience drove us there, and then cost made it possible. But that's not a real clear evaluation of the quality. And we know that there are days when it's worked well and days when it hasn't worked so well, as is it the case in any industry. And I guess I'm looking for partnerships in raising my kids. I know that when they were born, I took on the responsibility for raising them. But I also know that when they're sick, I take them to somebody who's been licensed by the state to partner with me on getting them healthy. It's their nurse practitioner, it's their pediatrician's office. I don't think anybody in the room wants me to handle that responsibility alone. And for me to just walk down the street and hear good things about somebody who claims to be a healthcare practitioner and have them take care of my kid. So I guess I'm interested in the quality rating piece as a way that the state can partner with providers and partner with parents to give us some assurance of quality. I'm wondering if anybody wants to respond to what that means for parents looking for quality daycare for their children.
And hopefully a brief response. We'll talk about that later. Dr. Dr. Tell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dabney, I just wanted to point out that many people in the state, many parents in the state agree with you on a survey that was conducted by Wilder Research looking at child care use in households. About 90% of parents said indeed they would appreciate a quality rating system, and it was even closer to almost 100% of some of the newer immigrants and low-income families in our state. So many parents agree that this is something that would be very helpful for them in seeking care.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the bill in the audience? Please come forward. In fact, if you could all come forward, it would be great so we can keep moving. Dr. Ephraim, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I apologize for not being here for the previous bill, and I empathize with Representative Dabney's issues as I was taking care of my own sick children. EdWatch's concern about both this bill and Representative Bly's bill to come, and I will not testify on that one separately, have to do with the teach language, the teacher education and compensation helps scholarship program.
Dr. Ephraim, if I may just interrupt, I think before you came, we adopted a delete all amendment. So the teach component is not in this bill. It isn't obviously in the Bly bill, as it's the center of Representative Bly's bill. So perhaps, if you'd like, we can wait till the Representative Bly's bill and have you offer testimony at that point.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, and with all due respect, but on line 232, it does mention teach of the delete all amendment, the DE1 amendment, unless there's a different delete all amendment that I don't see.
Dr. Efram, I stand corrected. The motion did remove the major components of teach, but you're right, there is a reference to teach on there. Please proceed.
Thank you. The child development associate credential is one of the degrees or credentials that TEACH supports. And TEACH, or the CDA, was developed by the National Association for the Education of Young Children, who developed the Council on Professional Recognition. The CDA requires the use of NIAC's anti-bias curriculum, which if we are dealing with issues related to closing the achievement gap, then EdWatch has serious concerns about using taxpayer funds for TEACH to promote this particular credential, which requires this use of this particular use of curriculum that brings up issues that have absolutely nothing to do with academic quality, issues of diversity training, revisionist history, homosexuality, sexual identity for 3 and 4 year olds, and activism with young children. I have copies here of quotes from this particular curriculum, and would strongly urge against using taxpayer funds for TEACH for that reason. The other thing I want to say on this particular bill is about the quality rating system. And while I, again, empathize with parents and Representative Dabney's concerns about quality, the quality rating system is still involving the use and potentially requiring the use of the early childhood indicators of progress, which are, again, contain many issues that are either broad, vague, and subjective on the academic areas, and contain other areas that are not academic and very controversial and not necessarily the role of the state to be setting norms in. In addition, we are giving money to a totally private entity who has returned money to the state because it did not want to be accountable as far as open meeting laws and audits. And we have a problem with that as well.
Thank you, Dr. Efram. Dr. Miller, I think you also want to offer testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Miller, Dean of the College of Education at Minnesota State Mankato. I have some contextual information that may be helpful. Mankato, the Nicollet County and Blue Earth County area, is involved in one of the MELT projects and has a very robust group of early childhood educators, child care providers, higher education faculty, and others, caring business members of the community that are involved in kind of assessing what happens and what are our gaps in the Mankato area. It seems in our area that we have, as with most communities, a great number of students who arrive at kindergarten and not prepared in a whole variety of respects. And most of those students, perhaps 50% of the students, haven't had access in the ways that we need to have them have access to high-quality daycare. We have 2 child care centers, 1 accredited in our area. Those tend to be a higher-cost area, and the students that end up, families that end up having their children in those particular centers are well-served, and their kids show up ready. There's a strong but limited space Head Start program in the area that provides child care as well as family education. support to a great number of people, but we have a huge gap in those services. There's a big gap between those two entities. There are a number of private and other kinds of services available in town, but there's huge gaps in the quality, and that leads to gaps in students' preparedness to enter school and be able to succeed. There's huge gap in a lack of services and support of families in that area as well. There's a great demand and a call for that. We have engaged the child care providers in town, and they do want high-quality professional development and other kinds of support, but we just don't have enough at this point to be able to meet the needs of the kids. And so it's that particular group of students, that children, that I'm most concerned about. The ones that don't have access, the ones that don't have money, that don't have transportation, that may not have the information or know how to use information to seek out the best quality services for their students. We have a large immigrant population, and some of those populations don't take advantage of access to those services, and so we've got a great deal of outreach necessary that we need to engage in. And we're looking at all services and all strategies to do that. Private funding, certainly legislative and other kinds of support would be very helpful to meeting those kids' needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Representative Peterson, any closing comments for us here today?
Chair Mariani, only that I think it's very clear, and if it isn't, we can certainly look at the language to make it more clear that this is a voluntary program, but a necessary one. If we want to improve the quality of services in those daycare centers, the licensed daycare centers, then we need to provide this kind of professional development or have it available. And as you just heard, 90% of those providers, the parents want to know that they have a quality system. And I would say that probably 90% of the providers want to have access to these services. They're already in place. This is just adding and expanding to the services that are already there. And I hope that you will support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Thank you for the spirit of give and take, members, on this important issue. With that, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 1089 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. And our recommendation will be that be further re-referred to the Early Childhood Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Representative Slawick, you have, we've got 15 minutes left in this part of our hearing. You have folks from New Prague, I believe, in the audience. And as I look at the agenda, they're the folks who are the farthest away. And I think at the very least would like to hear their testimony. And we also do have Representative Bly's bill up, which is the TEACH component. So I think what I want to do, Representative Slawick, is at the very least have the New Prague testimony. We'll kind of play it by ear in terms of how much time we have left there. I may circle back, but why don't we just tee your bill up. If you can move your bill, we'll have it before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1196 to be passed and go to the Finance Committee and then be re-referred to the K-12 Education Finance Division.
Thank you. Representative Slavik moves House File 1196 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee for a recommendation to be re-referred to K-12 Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And really, this is a simple bill, Mr. Chair and members. I think we could actually get done and out within the time we have and maybe even start on Representative Bly's bill. This is the third time we've carried this bill. I've had this bill a number of years. It's really pretty simple. It allows a pre-kindergarten child with disabilities to receive care and education services in a non-resident district at the election of the child's parents. Here's an example. If I live in North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, but my child goes to child care in St. Paul, so you hear about the capital. I do have a special ed child, so if he needs his services over in this district, the question is, how is he going to get them? and who's going to pay for it. So what this does is it allows a special ed child to receive their services. Remember, these are really little kids. The little guy's getting special ed services. To receive their services in the district where the child care is provided, but it's paid for by the resident district. So with that, I'd like to turn over to my testifier and have him talk about why this is important. It really doesn't cost that much to fix this. It also is already in statute at the K-12 level, so it's really just taking it down to the pre-K level.
Mm-hmm. Welcome, sir, to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Darren Kermis. I'm the Director of Special Services for New Prague Area Schools. I'm also the Executive Director of Special Ed for MERVSEC, which covers Jordan, Belle Plain, New Prague, Shakopee, Prior Lake, and Montgomery-Lonsdale. So that's kind of my region. I am the legislative co-chair for the MACE, the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, and that's, we are the group very much supporting this bill. It's your state special education directors. And as Representative Slawik mentioned, what this bill does in its purest form is simply extends a policy that applies and has applied for many years for kids in K-12 and extends it down to pre-K students with disabilities. We believe that the impact here is about 100 children every year that right now do not get special education services because their parents are placed in a position of either accessing their right to entitled special education services or not being able to have the same choices for where they want to go for child care services or in a Head Start program. Again, we very much support this bill, and I know the time is of the essence, so I would certainly be willing to answer some questions from the perspective of local school districts, special education at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Kermis. Are there any questions for Mr. Kermis? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Ehrenson.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani. I just wondered if the School Boards Association had an opinion on this policy change.
Is there someone here?
Yes, maybe not, since we're not down here. But
I think we do have someone here from. Yes, we do. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. At initial glance, Mr. Chairman, our concerns would probably be fiscally related in that our cost for this kind of programs would be reflected with an appropriation to provide this service. It seems to be as we expand mandates on schools, we oftentimes don't add that appropriation at the end to make it workable. But certainly since we provide it in K-12, it's not out of the ballpark to think pre-K it would also be a good idea. But once again, cost and district's ability to afford providing this service would be difficult.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. Representative Slawik.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, I mean, that there is a fiscal amount being requested, and it's come in, we think, about $500,000?
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal note that was previously requested came in at about $500,000. In reexamining this with department staff and looking at this at the district level, I believe that the new fiscal note will come in considerably lower than that. In fact, our best estimate now is about $250,000. Again, we are anticipating about 100 students a year. And a couple things I'd like to point out. This does not expand eligible students. The students here are already identified as having disabilities. So it's not expanding the scope of kids. It simply ensures that they get services. And again, we're the best pre-fiscal note guesstimate that we have is about $250,000.
Thank you, Mr. Kermis. Thank you, Representative Ehrenson, for flagging that for us. I think we have a question for Representative Erdahl.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Slawik, I believe that there's a legislation that we passed recently. I think Representative Ryland has been working on this regarding the K-12 tuition rate for special education. There's a problem with students going from a resident district to a non-resident district and having a cost level that's been established, but being billed more than the cost of the program. And this is pre-kindergarten, but does that apply for this as well, that program? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kermis.
Yes. Representative members, to a certain extent, this does apply. The current fiscal tuition billing process has a couple of flaws with it, and those flaws would extend to any tuition bills for children with disabilities, which would include this group. I believe that if the overall tuition billing issue is addressed, it certainly covers this as well. I do not believe that this adds anything to the discussions. It's simply another small piece of that puzzle. And I will tell you that approximately 75% of the districts already do this voluntarily and are already caught up in that, some of the issues with the current way that the tuition billing is done. So it already has an impact for those districts that are voluntarily doing it. But yes, I would, as an aside, I would highly encourage you to do everything you can to address the tuition billing and the special ed cost pieces, because they do impact not only this, but all of the areas of special education that we deal with at the local level.
Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I certainly hope that these flaws are addressed. I have a district, Litchfield, that last year paid $50,000, and this year it's $250,000. We need to look at this.
Representative Gutlock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would speak in favor of this bill. I do have a question, if I could, of Representative Slowick. We refer to disabilities in here, and I'm wondering, is there a state, when we use the term disabilities in a bill, and this is a rookie question perhaps, does that automatically refer to something in statute that defines what we mean by somebody with disabilities, or does that need to be more formally addressed in the legislation?
Mr. Kermis.
Thank you.
Representative members, the definition of a child with a disability is already in both federal law and IDEA and in state rule, and so it does apply to all of those existing categories, the 13 categories defined in Minnesota rule.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gutwein. Excellent question. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Small, a quick question on line 220 through 224. It talks about all districts that provide care must locate, identify, and evaluate all resident and non-resident infants, toddlers, and preschools who receive care or education services within the district. Could you, and then it goes on to say that the parent or guardian can choose whether they have them evaluated in the resident or non-resident district. I'm a little confused by must locate, identify, and evaluate those who receive care. Is that to go find them, or is that after they show up and register that they go back out and know where they live? I'm a little confused as to what this is saying.
I'm going to ask the testifier to respond to that.
Mr. Kermis.
Representative members, the language here is somewhat plagiarized from federal law. This is the definition, the requirements, and idea for what's called child find. It uses these language, locate, identify, and evaluate all resident students. What this does, there was a question that in the absence of this, the 2.20 to 2.24 language, the desire was to keep it so that in some cases, even though a child may be receiving services in a district other than their resident district, their parents or that district may want to go ahead and provide the early childhood special ed services in their resident district. What this does is allows for that to happen, that it may be either the resident district or in the other district. It gives a little bit of discretion there. And these standards about locate, identify, and evaluate students are what we as local districts are already held to under federal law. This simply now means that we would look, for example, in New Prague, we have St. Wenceslas, we have Holy Cross, where there's a preschool program. We go and work very closely with Holy Cross to look at their students with, in preschool who may have disabilities. Two, three weeks ago, there's a student attending Holy Cross from Northfield. So we worked with Northfield Schools, and we will go ahead and provide the services. That, by doing that, by having that relationship with Holy Cross and by working with Northfield, we are in New Prague already living up to the standard, because this is what's required under federal law. And we did it without regard to whether the student happened to live on my side of Interstate 35 or the Northfield side.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any other questions? Well, with that, then, Representative Slawik renews her motion that House Bill 1196 be recommended to pass, referred to the Finance Committee, and this is headed for Representative. And our recommendation is that that be re-referred to K-12 Finance. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Kermes. Members, we're going to stop here. Representative Lai, I apologize. I was hoping to get to you, but we only have a couple minutes left, and I think it's important for us to recess early. So what we'll do is we will officially recess and reconvene at 6 p.m. And we're reconvening here. Are we here in this... So we'll be here again in this room. So we're reset. Michelle said.
Please take your seat. This morning we did not approve the minutes from Thursday, March 1st, 2007. Representative Benson, would you please move those minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to move the minutes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Benson moves the approval of the minutes from March 1st. 2007. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 1st, 2007 are approved. Members, obviously this is the second time that we've met today, and we're going to try to finish up the bills that we have left over from this morning. It is important to all of us that we move swiftly. We don't want to cut testimony off. We don't want to leave with none of the bill, with some of the bills not heard, but we do need to move along. And so what we are doing is we have allotted about 15 minutes per bill. So if you have a bill up today, if you would just kind of watch the clock and help us out, talk to your testifiers and see if we can't keep each bill confined to about a 15-minute period, and you get extra credit if you're done before the 15 minutes is up.
Thank you, Ms.
So let's go ahead and start with House File 814, Representative Bly. We have a teacher education and compensation program established and money appropriated. Representative Bly, there you are. Representative Bly is not a member of the committee, so the chair moves that House File 814 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, with the recommendation to re-refer to Higher Education Division. In order, Representative Blight, is my understanding you have an amendment?
I do have an amendment.
And
it's the H0814A1 amendment.
Okay. The chair moves adoption of the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would desire. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Bly, please present your bill.
Okay. House File 814 puts language into statute establishing the teach and retain programs.
Oh.
Also includes an open appropriation for state funding. Teach is a scholarship program that helps child care providers, both center workers and family child care providers, earn a college degree in early childhood education or child development. A scholarship up to $5,000 per year pays for a large portion of college tuition and books. Successful scholarship recipients also qualify for a bonus upon completion of their scholarship contract.
The RETAIN program provides stipends to supplement the income of qualified early childhood professionals, both centered workers and family child care providers. Stipends can range from $1,000 to $3,500 and are progressively higher based on the provider's level of education. The program requires that the provider has at least 1 year of experience in the field and a commitment to stay in the place of employment for 1 year. RETAIN increases the quality of child care by reducing staff turnover and rewarding higher education levels among child care professionals. We hear talk about making sure that we have quality child care programs, and I think one way to do that is make sure that we can offer the training to and advancement to the providers, and also give them the opportunity to improve their wages by this kind of advancement. So this is what the bill attempts to do, and why I'm bringing it to you. And okay. I have some testifiers who would also like to speak to the bill. So we'll start with that.
And please, good evening, and welcome back. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I'm Ann Kainer Roth, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. And appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill before you this evening. And thank you so much to Representative Bly for bringing this issue forward. The bill before you, House File 814, is again a quality leg of our three-legged stool that we spoke about this morning, and is an important component of ensuring that child care providers are well equipped to operate at full potential. House File 814 provides state funds for the Teach and Retain programs. And as Representative Bly said, the TEACH program is a scholarship program for early childhood providers to receive higher education and early childhood development. The RETAIN program is a stipend for early childhood providers to encourage them to stay in the field and to get higher levels of education. Child care providers are some of the lowest paid workers in the state, with salaries that rival those of dishwashers. And not surprising, the turnover rate for child care providers is typically about 30% annually. The quality of child care depends on the professionals who provide the care, on their training, their education, and their stability in the workplace. The Teach and Retain programs are successful in providing resources to providers to get more education and training and increase their wages in order to stay in the field. And with that, I'll turn the mic over to Valerie Peterson to talk more specifically about the program.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Peterson. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Peterson. I work for the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network. I administer the Teach and Retain programs. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. As many have already testified today, strong early childhood programs are important in preparing young children to succeed in school. We cannot have strong programs unless we have strong staff. As Dr. Tout attested this morning, research suggests that consistency in teaching staff and child care providers who have a formal education in child development are both factors that contribute to a child's success. The Teach Early Childhood Scholarship is designed to help teachers become better educated while reducing turnover in child care programs. Teach is a scholarship that helps those working in child care to complete a degree in early childhood education. The vast majority of the scholarship money is paid directly to Minnesota colleges for tuition and books. Recipients also receive other supports, including a small travel stipend. Last year, we awarded nearly 200 scholarships to child care providers. On their behalf, we purchased over 2,200 college credits. As a result of their increased education and longevity in the field, these providers saw an average wage increase of 9% and reported a turnover rate of less than 3% compared with the 30% that Ann just mentioned in the field as a whole. Once a degree is earned, providers qualify to apply to the RETAIN grant program. This program supports child care workers who hold degrees, allowing them to remain working in child care, a traditionally low-paying field. That means less disruption for children as they prepare for school. I'd like to introduce you to Melanie Getz, who is a recipient of both the TEACH Scholarship and the RETAIN grant.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Getz.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melanie Getz. I am a preschool teacher here in St. Paul, and I'm a recipient of the TEACH and RETAIN programs. Being a recipient of the TEACH Scholarship has had a tremendous impact on me as an early childhood professional. Because of TEACH, I was able to return to school and graduate with a child development degree. excuse me. The classes that I took gave me the tools that I need to be an effective preschool teacher to build the foundations for learning for children in my class. I also received the training that I need to assist parents with getting their preschoolers ready for kindergarten. Because of my schooling, I'm confident that I provide the quality care that parents deserve and expect for their children. I consider myself very lucky to be a recipient of the retained grant as well. I love being a preschool teacher, but as mentioned, it's a very low-paying job. For me, the retain is an extra motivation to stay committed to my field. It provides me with the financial incentive that I very much need, and it makes me feel as though my dedication to children is appreciated and valued by this community. I'm not sure what I would be doing right now if it weren't for the teach and retain programs. In a field where turnover rates, as mentioned, are very high, I've remained at my place of employment for 6 years. That's 6 graduating classes of preschoolers that I've seen off to kindergarten. They were ready and they were eager to learn, and I'm proud to say that I contributed.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members? Everybody's trying to earn a little extra credit tonight, I see. Any public testimony in favor of the bill? Anybody else want to testify in favor of the bill? Anyone want to testify in opposition of the bill? Oh, I think we're going for A+. Mr. Bly, Representative Bly, do you have any closing comments?
Just to say that I think this is an important bill, and I hope that you will move it forward to the Higher Ed Committee and we can present it there.
Okay, thank you, Representative. The Chair moves that House File 814 be recommended to pass as amended to and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The bill is... The motion passes.
Thank you.
I was going to say amen. Getting my format mixed up. Hallelujah. There we go. Okay, the next bill up is House File 1325, Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson, you may move your own bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure where I'm going to move this to the finance. Okay. Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 1325 to the Finance Committee. And I do have a delete all that you have in front of you also.
Yes. Do all the members have a copy of the delete all? It is DE3.
DE3.
Yes. Okay. We need to adopt that amendment. Representative Peterson, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I would. I would move the delete all amendment, which is DE3.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Motion prevails. Go ahead, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here as I have 2 testifiers and 15 minutes goes very quickly. This actually was the old or former High Five bill, now revised. And that was a bill, that was a program which was in place for many school districts around the state until a few years ago when budget cuts demanded that it be eliminated. And so we no longer had that program. And that basically dealt with students who needed, who might be at risk and needed additional time, either 4 or 5-year-olds, in which to get ready for kindergarten. This is now called the pre-kindergarten program, and it's a program for 4-year-olds, and it would provide dollar amounts. First of all, it would have to be approved by the commissioner as the other program did, and you can see from the program characteristics that it has some guidelines as to what the program must include, including a learning plan created by the family and teacher. And the student would have to be 4 years old on September 1st, have completed the developmental screening,
and qualified for free and reduced lunch or be an English language learner who's 4 years old on September 1st. And then that student, this student, the four-year-old, would, in this preschool or pre-kindergarten program, would get the per pupil dollars the same as a kindergartner, a half day. In other words, half day for 5 days. Now, this would be similar or about as cost as effective as the scholarships which are being bandied around and or the allowances. And at least, I shouldn't say bandied around, talked about or at least discussed and put forward. I imagine that the amount would be approximately the same for the scholarships or for this particular funding method. This has a system already in place. We already have those programs in place and, ready to, in terms of funding at least, already in place in a school district. And it provides the coordination and the kind of continuity of instruction and curriculum that it really is important in terms of getting our students ready for kindergarten. And I have... But three testifiers, all of a sudden, who will talk about the programs, how it would benefit them.
Hey, Representative Peterson, I don't have a list of your testifiers, so would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Good evening. My name is Sally Ginn. I represent the Robbinsdale School District, which was one of the districts that had we called it Fives Alive. We had a program. We still have preschool in the district, and as you know, that from previous years in preschool, it's traditional, as you knew it back when you were kids, too. Our preschool program started in 1975 with one class. Parents, moms just brought their kids to school. We have now grown to 17 classrooms, over 300 kids, and as you can imagine, the population has changed dramatically. This year we have about 15 languages other than English. About almost 25% of our students speak something other than English in their home. Last year one of our classes had six languages in that represented in one class of 20 children. 10 of those children did not speak English on the first day of school. So we think it's been a huge benefit for the English language learners in the district and the low-income families. About 16% of our families are under $20,000 a year. And I guess one of the, just to keep with the A-plus grade, one of the stories I'd like to share is one of the little girls in our program last year, she came in as her mom was bringing her in a cab, and the mom couldn't afford cab fare in two directions. So mom brought her in a cab. They stayed at our early childhood center, and the little girl did not speak English. She wouldn't separate from her mother. She was crying. She wouldn't play with anybody else. So we worked with the district, got her moved to another facility, another classroom in another building, and we were able to get a bus for her using the district buses so that she could then separate from her mother. But she spent most of the year last year, she started by crying. She stopped crying eventually, but she didn't talk much. She didn't smile a whole lot. She could do puzzles and do things. But then fast forward to this fall, I was in the kindergarten classroom and she blended in. I did a double take. She was out on the playground skipping and talking to some other little girls, and I just don't think that would have happened without the preschool and the funding that we received from the state. My colleague was going to come and talk about also in the district the transition that we have to kindergarten. She helps manage the transition between kindergarten and preschool. We do a lot of joint staff development. We have kindergarten teachers do a tips for parents, and it's published in about five different languages so that parents can see what they need to work on with their children as they prepare for kindergarten. Are the files that the kids have in pre-K go on to kindergarten so that those teachers, it kind of makes a nice seamless transition and helps them get ready for kindergarten. And then I will just say another example, two more examples of closing the achievement gap, which we think we're doing with good preschool and good quality teachers. Most of our teachers have been with us for over 15 years, and so we are doing a great job with that. But we had a little boy who came in the beginning of this year. He didn't know any letters, no colors, no numbers, and now he's, you know, he's not completely there, but he'll be ready, much more ready for kindergarten than he would have been without this class. We also, so I mentioned the little girl that didn't speak English and cried and was quiet. The opposite extreme this year is a little boy that we have that doesn't speak English and came in, and he didn't have any exposure to other children. He was only in a home, like in an apartment with his parents, and he is so excited. When he started school in the fall, we didn't know how we were going to manage to be able to keep him in the class because he's just shrieked and squealed, and it's kind of with delight. When they would sing songs, he had no idea what was going on, so he would just babble really, really loud, and it was very disruptive, and it was a huge ton of work for the teachers and the different program staff to be able to settle him down, but I can say he's calmed down, and he should be going on to kindergarten next year with a lot more success. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing those examples. Next testifier is?
Hi, I'm Maureen Seiwert, the Executive Director of Early Childhood Education for the Minneapolis Schools. And we're here tonight to testify on behalf of this bill and also the extended kindergarten bill that Representative Dabney will present later.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. That's all I'll say on that at this time. Our goal in the Minneapolis schools is to support and promote the healthy growth and development of our youngest learners, and so they come to school ready for school success. We really believe our High Five program is a phenomenal example of a high-quality early childhood program that anyone would be grateful to send their child to. Our program was cut about in half a couple of years ago. We have pieced together funding to be able to continue. We serve about 340 students right now, and we have are just showing phenomenal results with those children. So I have actually tonight Annie Pearson, who is a very seasoned High Five and kindergarten teacher, is going to talk more about the specifics of what we do in High Five and how our children are excelling.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annie Pearson, and I think Maureen was trying to politely say I'm quite old. I have taught preschool and kindergarten in Minneapolis for 28 years, and I've had opportunities to experience the power of quality preschool and the impact that it can have on children's lives. I'm passionate about being here tonight and increasing opportunities for more children to succeed. High Five is a high-quality, literacy-focused early ed program for four-year-olds. It's a half-day program designed to boost children's school readiness skills. High Five opportunities are very limited at this time, targeted at the neediest preschoolers at the highest poverty schools in our district. High Five is a successful and high-demand program. High Five grads consistently outperform district averages on the beginning of kindergarten assessment, regardless of income status. Early analysis of data indicates that this trend of higher achievement continues as students progress, and it's reflected in their MCAs as well. High-quality, well-trained teachers and developmentally appropriate programs make huge differences in children's lives. If you want to look at ways to begin closing the achievement gaps, don't look any further than where you're looking right now, because we really can make differences for kids. High Five's popularity is evident. Last year, Minneapolis had over 1,100 requests for those 340 slots, and we didn't advertise at all. We didn't do anything to promote the program other than run in the school choice things, just a little box. Families want a quality preschool experience for their children, and very few are able to get it. Over half of the incoming Minneapolis kindergartners lack necessary early literacy skills, and as shown on the beginning kindergarten assessment, and one-third of the children that we screen in Minneapolis qualify for school readiness programs based on indicators on the screen. We need more opportunities for our young children. You've seen the articles and the research. We don't have to show anymore that it does good things, but I want to tell you some stories about some children so you can see how it affects kids and families. I brought pictures because I keep these guys in my heart. This is Travell. Travell's mom brought him to school on two buses one day because he missed the bus at the homeless shelter. He moved to the homeless shelter twice during the course of his year in High Five, and he didn't miss a day of school. His mom came when she was trying to leave the shelter to find an apartment with the address of the apartment she was looking at and wanted to make sure that he could still go to High Five if she moved to those apartments. She said Travell has a chance, and she wants him to have that chance. Then I want you to meet Munira. This is one of my favorite little girls, except that I always had to push her to eat her lunch. Munira picked up English like crazy. I mean, she was a chatterbox after about 3 months in school, and she loved numbers and counting. So you can see her at lunch. She's busy counting her goldfish and making up number problems about them, and I'm saying, honey, you got 3 minutes left to finish lunch. And she's telling me, if 3 fish swim upstream and 2 more stream fish join them, you have 5 fish. So that's Munira. This is Katya. She was in High Five. And when her dad came to school, to open house, he said, you know, we were talking at conferences. He asked about homework and helping her at home, and we talked about those things. And he said, I can't because I don't speak English. And I said, but you can help her in Spanish. And we'll help you with English. I sent home books that were in Spanish and English, and he kept asking for more and more and more because he would read them in Spanish to Katya, and then she would help him with English words back so that they were learning together. The next year on an open house day, Jonathan, who was Katya's cousin, showed up with Dad, and Dad said, I want Jonathan to be like Katya. I want him to be smart too. So he, on the first day of open house, before we even had done the conferences, started hauling books back and forth because he wanted the same things for Jonathan. Jonathan was reading over 120 words a minute at the end of the first grade assessment when I checked last year. And Jonathan's brother was on our waiting list all this year. He's still on our waiting list. But his dad called me at my office and said, Jonathan's little sister, they sent in the card, and would I please make sure there are more spots next year? So I want you to think about the kids and the impact you can have on kids' lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson, and thank you for sharing your passion with our committee. Any questions from members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Executive Director from Minneapolis, do you track these students or, you know, follow their schooling into middle years, for example, grades 3 through 5, so you can watch the accountability play out that I hope, you know, you had in place when they finished the program?
Yes, we are. Actually, we've just started to do that in the last 2 years.
Sorry, please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Maureen Seiwert, Executive Director of Early Childhood for the Minneapolis Schools. We have really worked very hard in our research and assessment department. Actually, one of my colleagues is here tonight as well, in connecting where children are in their beginning kindergarten assessment, which is an assessment that is done on every child who enters school in Minneapolis. That assessment has now been tied. There have been benchmarks established connected to the third grade reading, and so it has also helped in recent years the new requirement to have student ID numbers at the time of early childhood screening. So we're having much more capability, or increasing our capacity, to really look at those things way down the road. But yes, we are, and they're positive.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Peterson and the testifiers. One, this is a very good bill, so I want to thank you for bringing it forward. But is it really for any school district in the state could then offer this program? Is that how it's designed? And do you see this? How many districts do you think would offer this? Is it sort of a phase-in, or how's that going to work?
Well,
Peterson.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. It is, at this time, it is open. The district has the option. They don't have to, but certainly, and they have to apply to the commissioner. And so it is with the idea that anyone who has students who fit that criteria and has those kinds of student needs can establish this kind of program. So it is for all around the state. And I think we have students all around the state that might need this kind of program. And this basically is a funding mechanism. And as I said, is probably similar to the funding mechanism of allowances or scholarships, probably the same kind of concept, just attached to a pupil waiting, the same pupil waiting that you would have for a half-day kindergarten. And again, layer these with other resources that you have so that you might, in some districts, find you could provide a full-day program. You could take some, there might be other funds from school readiness or from ECFE, who knows. In your district, you may have some so that you could start layering and provide for the neediest at least a full-day program.
Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 1325 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would like to officially thank our testifier who came back this evening after she was here this morning to testify. That's a real commitment to this bill. Thank you very much.
We appreciate that also. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Okay, House File 1561, Representative Faust. Please come forward. And you might need a few extra chairs there, huh? Representative Faust, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move House File 1561, and I will recommend that it move that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you the rest of the committee. And thank you, Representative Bly, for going so quickly in his presentation and giving me his extra time. I appreciate that. So.
Oh, no, there's no extra time here.
I thought I should try it. So. I'm going to save my comments for the very end and let the experts talk first. And so I will turn it over right away to Robert Waddell. Waddell.
I'm sorry, for who? I'm sorry, what is your name?
Good evening, Madam Chair. Bob Waddell. I'm here this evening testifying on behalf of Education Evolving. But I'm really here in strong support for this bill. You all know, of course, about the rising cost of special education. That's not new to you. I know you've spent many, many hours discussing that particular issue. But the bill before you, I think, really deserves your strong support because it really is a different mechanism for making sure that the children and youth get the services that they really need when they really need it and not have to wait until they are no longer successful and fall so far behind that they really then qualify for special education services. So I think really the question that we have to begin to address is in this time of a very significant change that we're all dealing with, are we willing to use different kinds of models to actually get different kinds of results, improved results, even at lower costs? Or are we going to continue to try to implement the current models when we know that the costs are going higher and higher? So part of this bill really is asking, are we willing to change? Are we willing to change by doing things differently, not by putting another new program on top of another new program, but are we willing to do what we're currently doing differently that will result in fewer children needing special education services? They will get what they need, but they won't need to have special education services. And it's going to cost less, but it's going to require change. We all know that organizations sometimes are very, very difficult to change. So that's what this bill really does, Madam Chair, as I read it. A couple of interesting points. The bill really brings all kinds of teachers together in our schools, whether they be classroom teachers, Title I teachers, special ed teachers, paraprofessionals, principals. It brings them together to focus on the individual needs of children like nothing you have ever seen before. Second, it requires the kinds of testing that teachers like. I'm sure you've all heard a lot about the No Child Left Behind testing and more testing taking time away from an instruction. This is the kind of testing that teachers like because it gives them immediate information about how well are the children doing and what do I need to do to change to make them learn better. And it gives them those results not 3 months later, not 5 months later, but today. Third, it does significantly reduce the referrals to special education. It doesn't take services away from children that need the services. It gets them services quicker, and it ultimately reduces the referrals to special education. You're going to see the data or talk about the data later that will demonstrate that. And we all know that by that happening, we are going to also then reduce special education costs. It is consistent also with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the federal law. So you don't have to worry about, are we going to run into problems with the feds? As a matter of fact, federal law encourages this kind of a model. It also provides what other states are already doing. At one time, Minnesota led the nation with this kind of a model. We have fallen behind. We are no longer the leaders in this kind of a model. We really need to reclaim that. One other thing, it provides a new model of leadership. And by that I mean a new model of assistance, I should say. The expertise in a lot of the education domains rests in school districts. So the types of services and programs and assistance that we're talking about other school districts will get assistance from districts like the St. Croix River Education District, like the Minneapolis schools, like Stillwater, where some of the very, very best people in the nation are. We're talking about people with PhDs that will be there working with our teachers throughout the state, providing high caliber assistance to those teachers. So school districts with high levels of competence working with other school districts, a new kind of model that we really need to implement in Minnesota. Madam Chair, I'm delighted to be here with you in strong support of this bill, but the bottom line is basically this. Are we willing to change what we currently are doing? Thank you, Madam Chair.
And let me finish your sentence. In order to get different results. I liked that line earlier. I thought that was good. Okay, who would like to go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris McHugh, and I'm the director of the St. Croix Education District, and I thank Commissioner Wadle for his comments. 25 years ago, we were privileged to be the field testing site for a large study done at the University of Minnesota that developed one-minute reading measures that have now become what I call the gold standard of assessment and is being used across the nation. And I think it's time, in the 25 years that we've done that, we've developed a model that you see on page 5 at the top. It's a graphic demonstration of our model that has three parts: assessment, instruction, problem solving, and organization. And what we've shown, particularly in the last 10 years, is that all of our students' achievement levels have increased. And that's shown on the graph at the bottom of page 5. That's not a piece of modern art, but rather that shows our data on the percent of students who are passing targets that we've set that we've statistically correlated to the MCA tests. And you can see from looking at that graph, even a cursory look at it, that we've moved from our students performing at the 30 to 40% level to up above 70, even into 80% between 80 and 90 in kindergarten. While at the same time, if I could draw your attention to page 7, the graph at the top is
Mr.
one that...
Thank you. I think it would be beneficial if we just indicated to members which packet we're in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's the colorful one that had the yellow top. I beg your pardon. Come on.
Okay, you're on page...
Page 7, the graph at the top shows the students at the 10th percentile, and you can see how over these same years with that very difficult group of students who are largely the focus of No Child Left Behind, how the achievement for those students, the most resistive to instruction, has increased. I think the chart that you'll find of most interest is on the top of page 8, and that shows the 10-year history of our child count in the area of learning disabilities. And you can see there that we've got a graph showing the state incidence of learning disabilities, also in our Region 7, which is central Minnesota, but then in how our five districts, the number of students we've identified has been cut in half from learning disabilities. As Commissioner Wadle said, that's not from adding things, that is from doing things different. Now, we've been privileged to receive grants from the legislature and from the department using federal money to refine this model and to disseminate it in Minnesota, and that's another purpose of this bill. If I could, Madam Chair, I'd turn it over to our Director of Special Education, Dr. Kim Gibbons, who can show you a graph or two of students that we've selected, and I think that gives you a feeling of what happens at the student level.
Thank you, Dr. Gibbons.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to be here tonight and to lend support to this bill.
Nice to see you again.
Thanks. Tonight, I am going to share some examples with you of some real students from our education district and share with you how teachers use regular data that's collected on these students to inform their instruction and intervene when student progress is insufficient. If you open your packet that is labeled Student Progress Monitoring Graphs for Data-Based Decision-Making, I'll just take 1 minute to show you how the tell you a little bit about how these graphs are set up. Along the y-axis is the number of words read correct in 1 minute, which, as Mr. McHugh alluded to, is a very good way, valid and reliable, to measure student progress. Along the x-axis, along the bottom, are weeks of, along the school year. So this graph would represent a full school year that a student is in school. Then you'll see a line that's drawn in on the graph. And what we do is, this student is a fourth grader who, in the fall of his fourth grade year, was reading 80 words correct per minute. And the team set a goal that at the end of his fourth grade year, he would read 112 words a minute. So they connected 80 to 112 and drew a line, and that's called the goal line. Then you'll see the individual data points where, as we monitored student progress, those are plotted on the graph, and then the teachers look, and usually they make a change in their instruction if 3 to 4 consecutive data points are below that aim line that's been drawn. So this first example is a student that began the year just a few points below target, but the team wanted to monitor progress so that at any time, if student progress was insufficient, they could come in with additional interventions. Now, in this case, the student maintained a satisfactory trajectory of progress, so there were no interventions that were added. On the second page, you'll see a second grade graph of a second grade girl in reading. And this student began the school year 18 points below the target score that was expected of all second graders. Again, a goal was set in the spring that she would read approximately 90 words read correctly, and then you can see that the team monitored progress. Every time that you see a vertical line that's drawn on the graph, you'll see little words like super booster, modified duet reading. Those are interventions that the team implemented with the student to try to change the progress. I'm not going to go into detail about what the interventions are, but I think that this shows, this graph in particular, shows the diligence of the school staff in responding to data and making changes when the data was insufficient, and then actually moved the student out of an intensive intervention back into the mainstream curriculum, which is the goal for all students. The third graph, again, is another second grade student who began the school year 27 points below the fall target. And again, you can see all of the interventions that were tried, and again, this is another example of a student that, with appropriate supports, met the target that was established. These are all students that 10 years ago very likely would have been referred for special education and likely could have qualified. So again, lending some support that we have lots of graphs that look like this across the education district, graphs that make me very happy that I think we're doing an excellent job preventing students from receiving a label of SLD. The last graph that I'll just finish with is a graph that we show to our parents and really, you know that it's important to engage parents in the educational process. This is called a box and whiskers chart, and the box represents the 25th to the 75th percentile. The bottom of the box is the 25th. The top of the box is the 75th percentile. Then you'll see those lines that shoot out. The lines on the top, of the line goes up to the 90th percentile, and then the line that shoots down from the bottom goes to the 10th percentile. And then each little circle is the student's data point, so you can really quickly look and see how does my child do in relationship to the other students in that grade level. So this was a student in first grade that was below average and not doing very well, and you can see that by their sixth grade year they were well within the average range. This is a very nice chart that our parents appreciate because it shows them again how their child is performing relative to typical peers, and they can see that the progress that their students are making over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McHugh. No, I'm sorry, Dr. Givens. We have one question. Do you mind, Representative Fultz, if we just take a question in, as we go here? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question is for Mr. McHugh. Your graph on page 8 that indicates the percent of students receiving services for specifically for SLD from 1995 through 2006, it's a very impressive graph for the number of students, especially from SCRED. Can you tell me what, in that same period, has criteria tightened up qualifying the number of SLD students? How has that impacted in this graph?
Madam Chair, during this period from 1995-96, through 2005-06, there in fact weren't any changes in state criteria, so we're dealing with consistent state criteria during this time, and we use state criteria as it is in place in ruling out to identify kids, students, but because we're intervening earlier with them, and because teachers have work in teams in which the special education teacher works with them together along with Title I teachers and our other resources, they work together as a team, and they don't feel the need to refer to special education because we're getting services to them right away.
One quick response. That makes this graph even more impressive. I just want you to know that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, you're welcome. I have just one comment for Dr. Givens. You talked about this particular student might be recommended back to special education pullout type program. And I really do have to think back to the years when I was in school and with students that were not performing to the average, they just got put in a different reading group. You know, they went into the Blackbirds group. And there's so many times where people ask us why the accelerated cost of special education, and it is just amazing to me that we have this type of data that we can rely on and help identify, and it just is going to naturally lead to a higher identification rate too. So this is the amount of the type of data that your district has collected is just impressive to me, and what information to be making powerful decisions then.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I had a question. Is this program designed for particular categories of special ed students? I mean, some particular behavioral special ed students, are you including those in this? I'm thinking autistic students, EB students, all those special ed categories, or is this strictly SLD, the learning disabilities?
Mr. McHugh.
Madam Chair, it's important to understand that this program is for all students in the school. This is a regular education program. Our schools, and some of this is in the packet because of time I didn't go over, but we do these one-minute samples of all students, particularly in our elementary schools, three times a year. And teachers look at a graph such as Dr. Gibbons looked at probably at the end of September, and then we print out the scores of the students, and they focus on all the students who are below the target that we have, for example, for the middle of first grade or end of second grade, for example, and then work particularly to devise interventions for those students who are not on track to pass the first MCA in third grade. So this is a program for all students, and obviously students with disabilities such as, I think you referred to, autism and others, they're referred to special education or perhaps come from early childhood special education with IEPs. We continue with that. But if you remember, basically the learning disabilities model that the Congress wants to change and we think should be changed is a wait-to-fail model in which you identify most kids with learning disabilities at about the third or fourth grade after they've fallen long behind and after the research says it is too late for them to become effective readers.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to follow up on Representative Wood's inquiry about the chart on page 8. The most important thing, of course, is that children are getting the help that they need and they're being able to move along as we would like them to. When I was teaching every year, it seemed during those years there were more and more and more young people being sent into special education and having all kinds of economic impacts, of course, on the rest of the program. So that's the most important thing, that kids are getting the help they need. But looking at your chart, with the drop in the numbers of students receiving these special services, I have a two-part question. One of them, in your situation, what kind of numbers are we talking about as far as children, if you can give me that? And secondly, since we're all looking and scrambling around for money for education, and I see dollar signs here that can be put in general program, what kinds of dollars do you think that you are able to put effectively in maybe other programs that would have had to go in special education or even growing special education? A two-part question there.
Who would like to
answer the first question about money, about numbers. We work for five school districts, and our total student enrollment is about 8,500. Our overall special ed child count is at about 10%, so that's about 850 students in special education, and then 2.4% of the total population is labeled SLB. Okay. So 2.4% of 8,500. I can't do that math in my head right now.
Mr. McHugh?
Madam Chair, with regard to the resource question, I think I indicated that basically I think this model is a different way of doing business, and we've made these kinds of gains with just using this model. Obviously, there's some cost with assessment. That's about $2 per student. Our teachers are meeting after school and during their prep time to do these monthly team meetings. And then we also have invested some of our federal money, disability money, in training, which we've always taken the position, since that money is not excessive, as you know anyway, to use that money as investment capital to improve services rather than expand services. And that's been an important 25-year position of our superintendents. I'm very proud of that. The point is, it can be done. I think, though, I do want to say that I think we are stuck now in going any further than we are, and that's the purpose of this bill in one of the sections, is to actually create some money that goes out to all the schools in order to do what's called a Tier 2 service. So those are the specialized interventions that the group of teachers don't have the resources to do. And I think the committees that have been out to the House K-12 Finance Committee saw last Wednesday when they were up at Hinckley, they saw our teachers stuck a little in the team meeting because they didn't have resources to solve some problems. Thank you, Commissioner Wadle wanted to comment.
That's a very, very good question, and ultimately you always want to get down to cost in terms of dollars, but also cost impacts how do people use their time. For example, after I left the Department of Education, I went to the Minneapolis schools. And one of the things that that the Minneapolis schools had done was did a study on how do psychologists spend their time under the previous model of what we call the IQ testing, standardized testing model, and how that differs under this kind of a model. And it found that that school psychologists were spending almost all of their time previously doing IQ tests. And also concluded that they were discriminating against a lot of children, and that was not a good thing to do. But under this model, they were able to spend their time helping teachers with managing with their academics, or also with managing student behavior. And that's another part of the bill that we haven't even talked about, and that Representative Peterson really did raise the question, is it just academics, or are we talking about behavior as well? And the same model can be very effective in terms of how do you manage the behavior of children across the whole spectrum in your classrooms, because we all know how one or two kids can kind of disrupt the learning for a lot of kids. They're not emotionally disturbed. They're just not behaving very well. The same kind of a model can be used for those kids, and the bill has a proposal to address that as well. So the bottom line is, yes, it is dollars, no question about it. And I think the reduction here in terms of kids being served in the learning disabilities program is about a 30% reduction. You can figure out the cost. But also part of it is that frees up time for professionals to work with other professional teachers to better meet the needs of other children.
Thank you, Mr. Waddell.
Thank you.
And then we have one more testifier. If you don't mind, we don't want to make this testifier feel like she is left out. So we will proceed and we'll continue with questions after you are done. Please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Mary Ruprecht, and I'm the Director of Special Education for the Rum River Co-op, which is hosted in Cambridge, Minnesota. But I'm not here as a co-op director. I'm here as the president of the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, MAESE. And as their president, I'm here to support this bill. I don't think I need to spend a lot of time talking about how much special ed costs have gone up over the years, and that concerns special ed directors as well as legislators. We really need to have more early intervention programs such as this so that we can assess kids early, remediate the small problems before they become more insurmountable. The wait-to-fail model that we presently use to identify students with learning disabilities is just not defensible anymore. The longer students fail, the harder it is to remediate the problems because of fear of failure. We need to intervene early using a problem-solving model such as that proposed in this bill to allow us to identify research-based appropriate interventions for students early in their educational careers. The proposed bill provides funding to establish centers in the area of reading, math, and behavioral supports. In order to provide training to districts throughout the state in these research-based practices, data from the SCRED districts provides evidence that these practices supported in this bill truly do impact student learning. It is the belief of MAESE members that early intervention programs such as response to instruction, or also called response to intervention, or school-wide positive behavior interventions and supports, also called PBIS, which is for the behavior part of the students with behavior problems, will and have decreased the number of students in the area of both learning disabilities and emotional behavior disorders. These kinds of programs are a major paradigm shift for us people in the schools, and it's going to require a lot of extensive training and support. We can't just do this overnight. We're going to need some help from people that have already been doing these things so that we can build our programs from the bottom up and do it right. This bill really does provide that support. So I'm here to just say the directors of special ed in the state support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to see you. Ms. Rubrecht here. She's one of my great experts in special education. But, you know, this is a program that Commissioner Segrin loved and motivated us to support over 10 years ago. So it's so good to see that you're expanding on this model, because Commissioner Segrin couldn't be here tonight, but as St. Croix District knows, this was very special and is very special to former Representative Segrin, now our commissioner. My question, though, for the testifiers from St. Croix, the Minnesota Reading Center that you want to establish, to what extent are you already somewhat of a reading center, and how many outsiders have you addressed through the program that you have presently, if any? Would you comment on that, please?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, we've actually established the Minnesota Reading Center. It's an informal name that we give because we do some programs, and we are very grateful to Commissioner Segrin for her support when she was with this, or with the Finance Committee, and also as Commissioner. One of the programs we do is Reading First, which is a statewide program. Most of the money in that program goes to selected district or schools that meet certain criteria, but part of Minnesota's plan was to have a statewide program. We received $200,000 every year for 5 years. Next year will be the last year, unless it's reauthorized by Congress, and then we would reapply if we are able to. And what we do with that is serve 13 districts. We're also in partnership with Serve Minnesota, which you're going to hear about in the next bill, and we provide the literacy training for them, which is Dr. Christina Sharon and then Carrie Bowman, who's our Reading Center Director, who you're going to have the opportunity to hear testify on the next bill. So that's another program that we're involved with. We're also doing, we also have done some just work where we have invited, where people contract with us, where we provide some support. An example of is on Friday, we sent out just an email to administrators around the state asking them if, or inviting them to come for a half-day free seminar on RTI, and we have close to 300 people coming, including a team from Madison, Wisconsin. And we'll do another one in June and probably have a different 300 people. So there is a great deal of interest in this around the state, as Representative Erickson is alluding to. Finally, the other thing that we're doing is we're the first district, and I hope we'll be the first of eventually all the districts, that are actually taking this methodology and using it as the centerpiece for determining special education eligibility. This is a new allowance that's actually one of the rare decisions that a local district can make without the permission of the state to do that. And we elected to do that last year under the direction of Dr. Gibbons. That's been very successful. We've had some problems with it, but we've been working with that, and we're hoping to, through the center, replicate and share our expertise. And I thank Representative Erickson for the question.
Wow, that's impressive. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, this committee wasn't part of going to Hinckley to see this program, so I'm probably asking some questions that you already have answers. But you still have IEPs, and do you use this process with your students who are on IEPs also, or are they kind of categorized in a different area? I mean, how are you dealing with that?
Madam Chair,
I'm getting so entranced here. Dr. Gibbons.
We do use this process once children are identified and
are served on an IEP. The process is the same in the sense that we write a goal for each student on an IEP as we're required to under law, mm-hmm. but much of our goals are the graphs are would look identical to what you see in your packet, that we link performance, we set ambitious goals relative to what the grade level expectations are when that's appropriate, but we know that the more ambitious goals we set, the more likely it is that the students will have accelerated rates of progress. So we set goals for students and we monitor their progress, usually weekly once they're in special education, and then it's the same concept that we look at the students' rates of progress, and when their data points are below their goal line, we intervene with more intensive special education services.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I make one more comment that fits along the same line? Part of many times when we're looking at kids with significant needs, like the children in special education services, the professionals sometimes use the terminology with parents that most parents simply don't understand. For example, I'm going to ask you, how many of you understand what I'm going to say now? The goal for your child is we're going to increase the visual and auditory processing, improve the visual and auditory processing so that your child improves from reading at the grade 2.2 level to the 2.9 level. What if I said the goal for your child is to read 112 words a minute? Your child is currently reading 32. So our goal is to increase your fluency from 32 words per minute in a second grade reader to 112. How many of you understood that? Now parents say, oh, that's what you're trying to do with my child. That's what this can do to help parent communication.
Good point. Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify in regards to this bill? Okay. Dr. Ephraim? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch, and I just want to say that we strongly support the intent of this bill. And we especially like the focus on reading and math and the efforts to prevent special education needs. And the data shows that 90% of the children in special ed have high incidence disabilities, and of those, 90% have reading problems. So we absolutely support the idea of this bill. And we commend Representative Faust for bringing it forward. Our only, we actually just have two concerns that we want considered as the bill moves forward. And the first is that although there's an emphasis on reading, which we think is very good, there isn't specific language in the bill dealing with intensive systematic phonics, which the data shows is the key part to improving reading. And they've pointed out that that's what they do in the program, and I appreciate that. But it would be really nice to promote that, given that whole language has been such an unmitigated disaster for literacy development for our children. The second concern relates to the behavioral intervention part, and while we all want to prevent emotional behavioral disorder labels and referrals to special education, it's not really clear in the language of the bill how one deals preemptively, how children are chosen, what data is used, what consent procedures are involved for behavioral intervention, and Mary emailed me some information today, which I looked at, but looking at the way they do it didn't clarify it, because the examples they gave only talked about children that were already identified with disabilities. And they talked about, and they again didn't talk about consent, and this was on the federal site associated with the IDEA regulations. So that would be our other concern.
Okay,
and
thank you.
The experts are just far from reaching consensus. There's not an agreement in the research on the effectiveness of psychosocial interventions. There's already over-identification of poor and minority students with DVD, and the available evidence shows that when you respond to the core academic issues, especially of reading, that a lot of the behavior will go away anyway. So we would prefer that the emphasis be on the academic issues.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Ephraim. What this bill is going to be recommended to go to the Committee on Finance, so I would suggest that you and Representative Faust possibly have some conversations and see if there are any of those suggestions that he wants to adopt into his bill or not. But otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and renew my motion that House File 1561 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you. Next bill, House File 1174. Representative Dominguez. I'm kind of liking that name, Dominguez. Carlos doesn't get it this time. I'm not doing a very good job with that, am I?
Okay.
Oh, that should have been a classroom light.
Representative Dominguez, since you are not on the E-12 Education Policy Committee, I will move the bill. So I am moving House File 1174 to be recommended and to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you.
Go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives, for listening to this House Bill 1174. It's a bill on the Minnesota Reading Corps program. First of all, it's a good night, and hopefully we can pass this bill with a lot of colors. Most of you already received the bill, and I'm just going to go over it real quickly. This establishes a Minnesota Reading Corps program to provide training and literacy instruction to AmeriCorps members who work with Head Start programs in pre-kindergarten settings and in kindergarten throughout grades 3 schools to evaluate the literacy skills of and to teach literacy skills to children ages 3 to grade 3. Madam Chair, I'm not going to speak too much because we have some testifiers, and I want to get an A plus, so we want to move on. Okay, so first of all, we have a testifier from Alice Seagram's office. So I think there was something passed out to all the members. So
Ms. Noble from the Department of Education, please identify yourself for the tape and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Claire Noble. I'm the Government Relations Director at the Department of Education. I'm here on Commissioner Seagren's behalf. She regretfully could not be here, but asked me to come and express her enthusiastic support for this bill. Commissioner Seagren was the original author of the bill that initiated this work with reading interventions, and so she has long supported this and continues to strongly support it, as do we at the department. Thank you.
Representative Dominguez, I have that you have another testifier, Ms. Suker.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Audrey Suker, and I serve as Executive Director of Serve Minnesota. And we administer the AmeriCorps program for the state. And those of you that know AmeriCorps well will also probably know it as a domestic Peace Corps. We are delighted and grateful for the opportunity to provide testimony on this special literacy initiative that we've been developing over the last 3+ years. And what the Minnesota Reading Corps does essentially is marry the people power of the AmeriCorps program with the science of how children learn to read. And we initiated the program in the fall of 2003 at the initiative of, at that time, Representative Alice Segrin. We began with 34 AmeriCorps members serving in Head Start classrooms across the state. We are now in our 4th year. We've expanded the model to target children age 3 to grade 3, and we currently have 150 members serving in 77 Head Start and K-3 sites across the state. And because the results have been so compelling, our agency requested $1 million increase to our state appropriation each year of the next biennium so that we could double the size of the Reading Corps to reach over 15,000 children over the next 2 years. We would match the state's $1 million appropriation with an additional $500,000 from the private sector, which then together would leverage $6 million in federal funds. And we are delighted, as you've heard earlier tonight, that the governor has included our request in his budget. And what we want to do today is let you hear from two of the literacy experts that work with us on the program, and then we also have two AmeriCorps members that want to make some brief statements. First, you'll hear from Dr. Christina Sharon, who's with the Evaluation and Research Division of the Minneapolis School District. After Christina, you will hear from Carrie Bowman. And Carrie is a school psychologist with the St. Croix River Education District and is a director of the other Reading Center. And after you've heard from our literacy experts, we'll conclude with letting you hear directly from our two AmeriCorps members, Emily Stenberg and Christy Fries. Christina?
Thank you, Audrey, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having us here today.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Yes. I'm Christina Sharon. I am the research and evaluation. I wear two hats. I do research and evaluation for Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'm a trainer and coach for the Reading Corps Serve Minnesota program. I'm going to be referring to this document, and I will start it, and then Carrie Bowman will finish. The Reading Corps is a project that has been focusing on, in the last 4 years, intervening with at-risk early readers. So we start with them at a very young age, 3 years of age, because we know that's when it starts. Actually, it starts at birth. And we provide training and coaching to these members who then go into Head Start classrooms and K-3 classrooms and provide research-based interventions on a weekly basis, 60 to 90 minutes a week with these children. They also, which in the end, the goal for us is to increase the literacy skills so that when these children do go to school, they're prepared, they're ready, they're going to be on track, and they'll be proficient readers by the end of third grade. And there's a number of ways we track that to make sure that what we're doing is making a difference. One of the things we do is that we provide training to all of the members and to teachers in these Head Start programs. And then we coach both the member and the teachers. And we, our goal is to, at the end of 3 years, that the each site will have their own coach, which we call an internal coach, who will take over that process. So that at each site, we build capacity so when we walk away, the things that were happening, that were making a difference in these children's lives, continue. The assessment tools we use are statistically reliable and valid for screening and progress monitoring. You've heard about these tools. They're general outcome measures, and the group before us talked about them. We're using the same. Our interventions are empirically supported by the National Reading Panel, and our training and coaching is research-based. If you could turn to page 2. The programs we are currently serving are both Head Start and non-Head Start preschools and K-3 programs. The training and coaching provides them with skills in knowing what to do with young children 3 years of age to 5 years of age, and then as children get, as the members work with the K-3 group, Carrie will talk about the interventions they use.
our biggest goal in our training is talk, read, and write every day, all day long. And we have a 3-3-3 rule. 3 conversations a day with children, 3 readings a day with children, and 3 writing experiences. Early on, those writing experiences include drawing, scribbling, but talking about it and adding meaning to it provides children with the information, helps them sort of make connections. If you look at the bottom of page 2, you will see measures that we use, and you will see spring targets. What we've done to establish those targets, and these are our assessment tools that we use. These tools are only used to assess pre-literacy and literacy skills for pre-K children. There are other kinds of assessments that are going on in these programs. Because we are a supplemental program with a focus on literacy, we can focus our goals and we can focus our assessments just on literacy. We want to know that children that are working with these AmeriCorps members and teachers that have been trained, that they're making a difference in these children's lives. And the only way we know to do that is to test these children on these 5 measures 3 times a year. And when we see that they're not making progress, then we need to step up and we need to change what we're doing. So really these assessments end up being teacher assessments. Rhyming, alliteration, picture vocabulary, letter name, and letter sound, highly correlated with children becoming proficient readers at the end of reading at the end of first grade, but being proficient readers at the end of third grade. You'll see these spring targets. How did we get spring targets? What we did in the Research and Evaluation Department and at the St. Croix River Education District was we looked at MCA scores and what did children have to do on a beginning kindergarten assessment before they came to kindergarten. What did they have to do on an oral reading assessment? What did they have to do on their NALT? What score did they have to achieve that put them at about a 75 to 80% probability that they were going to pass their test, the MCA test? And then we came up with a set of targets, and that's what we worked towards. If you go to page 3, you will see at the end of 3 years the results. It's hard to read the numbers at the bottom of the first graph, but if you just notice how all of the scores continue to go up and that the last score, which is in red, is particularly significant in that children start at a very low level and end up on target or above target. And the percentage that are on target at the end of this experience continues to grow. At the bottom is a particular study that we did in Minneapolis. We have a huge population of Head Start children that come into our school. Probably 1,000 children come to Minneapolis Public Schools from Head Start. PICA Head Start is one of our largest programs that has participated in this for 3 years. And what we did was we took a group of children, we set up 3 groups of children, and we matched 1-to-1. It's called a matched sample experiment. And we looked at children who were in poverty or high risk and matched them with a group of children in Head Start who were not receiving Reading Corps, and then to a group who were receiving Reading Corps. And if you can just look at the bottom scores, you can see that the group that was in the Reading Corps that had AmeriCorps members and training and coaching, which would be the red bar, did significantly better than children who were not in any Head Start program but had the same liabilities and high-risk behaviors, and then even better than the children who were in PICA but not a part of the Reading Corps program. I'm going to move.
Ms. Goldman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Bowman. I work for the St. Croix River Education District, and I'm involved with the Minnesota Reading Corps program with the literacy design in terms of training and coaching and data collection and assessment. I want to tell you more information about the K-3 portion of the Reading Corps program, beginning on page 4 of our handout. The K-3 portion of the Reading Corps program provides supplemental one-to-one tutoring using empirically supported specific reading interventions to students who are
performing somewhat below grade level in grades K through 3 in reading. And second part of that program is that the AmeriCorps member working with the student takes one-minute sample of student performance once a week and then graphs those data similar to the graphs Dr. Gibbons showed you in the last group that testified to be able to make decisions about the ongoing intervention needs of the children in order to promote their success. On the second slide on page 4, the specific assessments that we use in each grade level, K through 3, are listed. Each of these assessments are empirically validated as reliable and valid for use as screening measures and also for progress monitoring tools. They also have all been correlated to the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. And as you can see, kind of visually on page 5, when we look at student scores on our general outcome measures, as those scores increase, those same students' scores on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment increase as well. Because those two outcomes are related, we can set target scores that allow us to predict with a high level of accuracy which students need additional support to be successful in meeting our grade level standards. The target scores that give us that information are listed on the bottom of page 5. So using these data, the grade level teams meet and determine the students who would benefit from supplemental support from the AmeriCorps member who has received training in empirical interventions to help students become better readers. They identify those students and set up the schedule so the AmeriCorps member can work with that student one-on-one outside of the core reading instruction time, so it's a supplemental support. And then we use the data to watch how the students grow and to make a decision about whether interventions should be changed and how they should be changed. From an evaluation perspective, it is interesting for us to take a look at the expected rate of growth that we would have for a student in a particular grade level versus the rate of growth that we achieve for students that participate in the Reading Core program. And the graph on the top of page 6 of your handout provides that exact comparison. You see at each grade level the weekly rate of growth that we would expect for students to maintain in order to maintain grade level status is listed in the green bars. And the yellow bars show the weekly growth rate that we achieved for students who participated in the Reading Core program. This is particularly impressive when you consider that every student that was chosen for the Reading Core program was chosen because they were below target. So they had already had an established pattern of making less than 1 year's growth in 1 year's time. That's what got them behind in the first place and why they were at risk. So we've taken this group of students who is growing slower than their peers and actually turned that around so that they're growing faster than their peers, making more than 1 year's growth in 1 year's time, which is what needs to happen in order for us to catch these students back up to target so that they have an excellent chance of meeting our grade level standards as tested on the MCA. We're particularly proud that this cost-effective, community-supported event that can be implemented school-wide and then statewide has had such impressive results for the students in our buildings and is an example of a good use of funds to really make meaningful results for students in achieving our goal of all students reading on grade level by third grade. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Dominguez, you have another testifier?
Yes, we do, Madam Chair. We have two AmeriCorps workers.
Wonderful. Would you like to introduce them, or would you like them to introduce themselves?
I think they're able to introduce themselves.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Crystal Lynn Fries. I am an AmeriCorps member with the Minnesota Reading Corps. I currently serve with the East Side Neighborhood Services Program in Minneapolis. Last year, I was a Reading Corps member as well. I worked at the Mary McAvoy Early Literacy Academy, which was a charter school. I earned my Bachelor's of Education, or BA in Cultural Studies at Bethel University, and
have also a professional certificate in teaching ESL from the University of California at San Diego. When we returned to Minnesota, I joined the Minnesota Reading Corps in order to get the education award that will help me to pursue licensure so that I can go on to teach ESL in the state. And since then, in the past 2 years, I've worked with over 30 children through the Reading Corps program at the school that I was at last year, and in the programs that I'm at this year. The majority of the students are fall not just a little below grade level, they fall a lot below grade level. For instance, I think of the 8 third graders that I'm working with this year, I would say about half of them started their reading level at the beginning of the year was at the kindergarten reading level, if not kindergarten first grade. Since then, one of them has moved from kindergarten all the way up to reading third grade level passages, and the other three are just a little behind where they're at the end of second grade level reading, based on the target scores that we've been given. And with all the kids that I worked with, that's the kind of progress that and training that we've received that we can pass along to these kids, where we can meet them where they're at. If they're in third grade and reading at a kindergarten level, that's where we start, and we help them climb up the ladder. And once they get it fast. In October, I started working with a second grade ELL student. She was just at the crossroads between being able to blend together letters into words and reading connected text. We worked for 2 weeks on blending words, then we moved up to primary level reading passages. That was in October. It is March, and 2 weeks ago she started reading second grade level passages. By the end of the year, probably at the end of April, she will hit the target for reading at second grade.
Thank Congratulations you, on that success. Next testifier, please identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Emily Stenberg, and I am an AmeriCorps volunteer serving in a Head Start classroom near Cedar, Minnesota in Anoka County. And basically, my role in the classroom is instilling early literacy skills into the children's and their classroom. I lead small groups every day where I play rhyming or alliteration games with the children. I work with some students individually who may need some extra help and developing a certain skill. And every day I lead SWIPLE, which is songs, wordplay, and letters, where we talk about our letter of the week. We read nursery rhymes, we sing songs, and we just learn more literacy skills. I'm really grateful for this experience and for this year. I just graduated from college last spring, and I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do, so I decided to volunteer, and when I found this organization, I was very pleased, and it just fit perfectly, and I've learned a lot, and I've decided actually to become a teacher.
Oh, congratulations.
Which I never thought I would ever do, so it's been a good year.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Demmer has a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not exactly sure who would like to address this. I'm looking at the... It's a great program. It makes all kinds of sense. But I'm looking at on the page 5, the bottom slide, the curriculum-based measures target scores. And I couldn't help but notice the fall scores for second and third grade are very similar to the winter scores of first grade. The fall score of the second graders of 43 is the same as the target score in the winter of first grade. In fact, the target score for spring of first grade is 49, and then we basically lose a whole spring, a whole season. And I'm just wondering, the learning loss, it looks like summer learning loss is what it is. We go from second grade, winter's target score of 72, spring of 90, and then back to 70 in fall of grade 3. I think we all know about summer learning loss, and that's it. Is that what we're seeing there? Any thoughts, observations?
Dr. Sharon? No?
Crystalyn Fries. I can respond to that, Madam Chair.
Ms. Fries.
What you're seeing is the children are tested at grade level. So a primary reading passage would be like Dick and Jane passages, or Gus is a dog, Gus can dig, where all the words are fairly, they're fairly decodable, thank you, where you can use basic phonics rules and maybe the silent E rule to sound them out. As the child progresses, the reading level progresses as well, adding endings, adding different digraphs like IGH, which looks like IG, but it says I. That increases with the grade level readings. And so while the numbers don't necessarily look like they're showing progress, you have to look across fall, winter, spring, where in fall at this grade level, so for second grade, at a second grade passage, in fall, they're going to read 43 words a minute to be on target. That same passage in the spring, they should be reading 90 words a minute. And then in third grade, the passage gets more difficult.
Christina Sharon, you're also looking at the average score. So you're going to have children within that band that are going to be above that score or below that score. But this is the average score that's going to take them to the target score.
Follow-up?
Yeah,
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I hear you saying that, then a score of 72 for winter in second grade does not really correlate to fall in third grade.
No, it does not.
It's different,
different
passages at a different higher level.
Absolutely.
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two different questions. One is you've talked about this being a volunteer program. And there's you're increasing the program by $1 million. What is the $1 million spent? Do we pay these two volunteers? Do they get any payment, expenses? Who's their employer? What are we spending $1 million on each year? The increase, $1 million each year.
Well, these two individuals, Audrey Suker, Mr. Minnesota, these two individuals do get a small living stipend. I can let them speak to the fact that that living stipend, they would make more working at McDonald's. Yes. they also do earn a federal AmeriCorps scholarship of $4,725 each year that they can use to further their own education or pay back student loans. In addition, the $1 million helps pay for the specialized literacy training and coaching that they've received. And you've noticed that both of these individuals have college degrees, and so the kind of training that they've received allows them to really become extensions of the literacy instruction team on site. And I also want to point out that the leveraging power, the primary funding for the AmeriCorps program comes from the federal government. So the dollars that we raise here, a dollar raised locally leverages four of federal. So it's really quite a return on investment in that regard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I follow up? One other question. You've discussed most of the issues around the reading, except the area of comprehension. Do you also focus on that? I didn't see much in that area.
The reason we, Christina Sharon, Reading Corps, the reason we do not focus on comprehension, or it doesn't appear like we're focusing in on comprehension, is because there's strong research support that says if a child is a fluent automatic reader, which would be a child who's reading 107 words at the end of third grade on a one-minute passage, that their comprehension scores, there's a strong correlation with comprehension at about a 0.7, which is pretty high correlation. So when you get a child's fluency at the target where they should be, that comprehension is highly correlated with excellent comprehension. And there are, in our trainings, we talk about the Big Five, and comprehension is one of the things we talk about. But we talk about it in reference to when a child has what we refer to as automaticity, which basically is this. When you read a word, you break it up into its individual phonemes, and then you quickly put it back together, and you do it so automatically that you don't know you're doing it. Because you are automatic, you have automaticity. That's what we are striving for with children, and that's what these one-minute measures help us do. Starting with letter sounds, letter name, and moving all the way up to oral reading. If a child is automatic in their decoding, I'm not spending any time thinking about this word. I'm reading this word, and I'm thinking about, what does this relate to? And then that ties in with the comprehension. And that's why there's such a high correlation between fluency and comprehension.
Thank you. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair Dietrich. And I first just want to pay you a compliment and say that this is a well-run meeting. And second of all, I have a few questions for Ms. Sharon and also the volunteers. I've been a firm believer in the AmeriCorps program because I've had a lot of opportunities to work with AmeriCorps volunteers in a number of different programs. And I know that we really get a lot for the amount of money that we actually invest, and it's a very small amount that we invest. And I know that your stipends are very small, and you do a lot of great work for that small stipend. So, first of all, I just want to pay you, both of you, a compliment for volunteering, because it truly is volunteering when you look at the amount that you receive. But out of this $1 million that the state's going to invest, and then we get the federal match, could you please provide me with the actual numbers of volunteers that we will have at our school sites across the state of Minnesota? So how many volunteers are we actually going to put on the ground? Second question is, for the volunteers, what's the average number of students that a volunteer will work with in a classroom? And then number three, how many students for each of you, if you could answer this, how many students do you give individual attention to on an average day?
Ms. Zucker?
Audrey Zucker, we plan with this $1 million to put 300 Minnesota Reading Corps AmeriCorps members on the ground in September of 2007. So if you can imagine extending that capacity, it's pretty huge.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you're doing a good job, too. My question for the testifiers.
We can call on you later. This is a well-run meeting, remember?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with data privacy and the distribution of the data. Could you tell us about how you protect your data, and do parents know that the data from their children's reading experiences may be shared? Would you discuss that a bit?
Oh, good question. Yes.
Christina Sharon, for the Head Start population, the benchmarking is done 3 times a year, and that data is done by the AmeriCorps members, and then the teacher codes those children's names. They each get a code, and then it's sent to SCRED, St. Croix River Educational District, and then they do the data analysis. So each classroom, each child is given a number, and each classroom is also coded. When we share the information to a group such as this, it's disaggregated or aggregated, depending on what they want to see and what the summary is. And so those numbers and those names are not identifiable. In the K-3 process and the K-3 programs, there's a similar process, except each local school is putting that data into their own system, which is a web system called AIMSWeb. And then they're printing off reports at the school that are then shared with parents at that school and reading teachers and classroom teachers when they meet in their teams.
Thank you, Representative Welty. And I do apologize. I did not know that you had a follow-up question. Except when they hit me over the head.
Madam Chair, if Congressman Welty could please repeat his second question.
Representative Welty, please repeat the other two questions.
I'm afraid so. Okay. The other two questions were, how many students does an average AmeriCorps member or volunteer individually work with on a daily basis? And then the second question was, what's your average class size that you're working in, or are you working in multiple classrooms?
Chris Lindfries, Madam Chair. If I respond to that, I'm working at two sites. I currently work with directly with eight students at each site for 80 minutes a week, which breaks down into four 20-minute periods each day. That number can be can greatly be multiplied because we bring in volunteers from the community as well. And in my case, I work with after-school programs, so I have reading tutors that I have trained using these methods and using these interventions. I train further volunteers, and they work with even more students. So we can multiply the number of kids that we work with just by bringing in more community volunteers. So at a site, I directly can work with eight in a day, but with the after-school program, with bringing in other community volunteers during the day, I can double or triple that number.
Thank you. Representative Welty, did you have another question, or were they both adequately answered?
Emily Sundberg. My role is actually quite a bit different than hers because I'm just in a Head Start classroom and in Cedar, and we have a morning session and an afternoon session, so two groups of 17 each day I work with. And I would say I work with probably three to four individually each day, depending on what else is going on in the classroom. And
is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify in regards to this bill? Okay, thank you. Then with that, I will... Sure. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Suker, you mentioned 300 AmeriCorps readers, AmeriCorps reading people on the. How many school districts will that touch?
Well, right now we have 77 sites, and I haven't actually counted up the number of school districts. So with this doubling in size, we expect to be at 150 different sites. We expect to have that split between Metro and Greater Minnesota. I'd have to do a little more homework for you about actual district numbers, and I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. If I could, is it roughly split between the Greater Metro area and Greater Minnesota?
Yes.
Half and half, roughly?
Roughly half and half.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. With no further questions, I will go ahead and renew my motion that House File 1174 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
you're welcome. Thank you.
Time to go home to my beans and rice now.
Next bill up is House File 1426, Representative Gabby. Representative Dabney, welcome. And since you are on the committee, go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1426 to be passed. It's late.
And re-referred to the committee.
Recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. And with a further recommendation to be referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. There we go. And,
I'll move
and
my
Madam
lips
Chair.
You speak.
Pardon?
I'll move my lips, you speak.
Very good. Madam Chair, I'd also like to draw to committee members' attention House File 1086. That is not in possession of the committee, but I want to thank the Chair for the opportunity to present both bills at the same time. Its lack of possession in the committee is just another one of those mysteries of the new structure this year.
Okay, so there is no confusion. Representative
Please.
Dabney did just make reference to House File 1086, but that bill we are not voting on. That is
correct.
Who is just going to be including some of the components as we talk about House File 1426.
That's correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll probably return to that theme again.
I bet we will.
Madam Chair and members, as I've sat in this committee, in the K-12 Finance Committee, over the last couple of months now, I think, I've picked up on three themes that have dominated conversation on both sides of the aisle. a strong sense of the need to look at closing the achievement gap in Minnesota. A strong desire to do what we know works and what we can demonstrate works. And lastly, getting the best bang for the buck for the taxpayer's dollar. I think House File 1426 or the alternative approach in 1086 meet all three of those goals. And the two bills offer a choice to committee members of kind of outside-of-the-box options for closing the achievement gap where it first manifests in kindergarten. We know the achievement gap starts before children show up on that first day of school. Either of these bills allows school districts to create extended kindergarten programs. House File 1426, which is the Kindergarten Plus model from New Mexico, in its purest form, targets at-risk populations defined by high poverty, free and reduced lunch counts, and allows school districts to bring in high poverty students into those high poverty schools 20 days before regular kindergarten starts, and then keep them for 20 days after regular kindergarten ends. I think of it as putting wings on the kindergarten year, and there might be an apt visual metaphor there for members. This program was started initially as a pilot in New Mexico in four school districts. Within 2 years, it started as a three-year pilot. Within 2 years, they had expanded the program to a number of more school districts in New Mexico because of the success they were seeing. And this year, the New Mexico legislature is considering legislation to expand this same wings on the school year model, expanding it from kindergarten up through grade four for at-risk students because of the success, the early success they're already seeing. It's striking. Early data analysis has shown that children in the Kindergarten Plus program in New Mexico score equal to or even ahead of their non-Kindergarten Plus peers. This is a program that we know works, has powerful impact, and provides real return on the dollars appropriated. I have with me tonight, Madam Chair and members, two testifiers who you might recognize from earlier in the evening, Maureen Seward and Annie Pearson, both from Minneapolis, who can talk about Minneapolis' experience with extended kindergarten opportunities in the past.
And who would like to go first? Please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Maureen Seward, and I'm the Executive Director of Early Childhood Education for the Minneapolis Schools. And I'm a new grandma. So I'm going to use an example here that my little granddaughter is Amelia. And I'm the mother of five. My children are all now young adults. And so I was unfamiliar with this new thing they call tummy time for new babies. The babies no longer sleep on their stomach. They sleep on their back to prevent the SIDS. And so you have to provide opportunities for little babies to strengthen their arms and legs and neck. Because if they sit in a car seat all day or in an infant seat or they're laying on their back, they're not getting the same chance to develop those parts of their body that will allow them to crawl and will eventually allow them to walk and dance and all the things that they do with their bodies. I see early education opportunities such as this extended kindergarten, the same kind of opportunities as Amelia is getting in when she's doing her tummy time. She's getting the opportunity, and these children are getting the opportunity to develop those parts of their bodies and their minds and their souls and spirits that they don't get the opportunity to do if they're not given the time and the energy and the exposure and the chance to develop those parts of their bodies and soul and minds. And so I support, as we talked earlier about High Five, in Minneapolis, it's a complex puzzle. Really a puzzle. There's a lot of pieces to healthy growth and development of our youngest learners. And so that to have children be really ready to go and excited and ready to be successful in school, we need to do a lot of different strategies. The AmeriCorps program, fabulous things for our children who are coming from Head Start. We have our High Five program,
We have had experience with having a summer school program for children going into kindergarten, and I think Annie will tell you a bit about the successes of that and really the losses to our students, the fact that we haven't been able to do it in recent years.
Thank you. Please identify.
Madam Chair, my name is Annie Pearson. And lengthening the kindergarten year is just another strong strategy that makes lasting differences in kids' futures. We were able a few years back to run Kindergarten Express programs where we were able to provide some sessions of kindergarten readiness for kids before they entered kindergarten. That funding disappeared, so we were unable to do that. And then last summer we were able to do two sessions. We got a grant from the library board, so we were able to run two sessions. We chose our two very highest poverty schools to place those programs at, and we served a total of 60 kids in those two programs. This morning I had a happy job because I contacted teachers, and in a time in the school year that is not notoriously happy for teachers, they're all feeling pretty overwhelmed and kind of overworked and really frazzled, and I got to talk to them about positive things, and that was really nice because all of the things that they could tell me about the kids who went through those programs were really positive things. They said feedback from the families was very positive, that families felt like they were supported in making the transition to real school, that there were parent educators who worked with them and helped prepare them for what was going to be expected from them. They said their kids weren't worried anymore. They were real confident heading out to kindergarten. They knew about buses and bathrooms and school cafeterias, and they got a chance to experience that before the school was quite as full. The teacher said that the students who came to them from these programs knew how to follow just basic routines. They got a chance to practice that hard job of separating from families, because lots of our kids, the time they walk into kindergarten is the first time they're away from their families, and so they got to get over that saying goodbye part in the summer. And when school started, they were really ready to go. Teachers commented that children involved were better able to follow school directions and school rules and routines, that they were the leaders when they started, that they had fewer behavior issues, that they had some confidence and some skill. They knew what the calendar was. They knew what they were supposed to do with it, and they were pretty pleased with that. And that their school readiness skills, just even with that short time, really showed kind of a dramatic difference. They understood how stories worked, and they were able to start identifying some letters and some sounds. They were able to do some cutting and to start writing some letters. So the teachers, like, overwhelmingly supported more opportunities for their students.
The other thing I think, I'm sorry again, Maureen Seiwert. Representative Demme,
I believe,
Demmer, talked about how we all knew about that summer loss. And so I won't go into too much testimony about that, but there is a significant amount of loss for students between kindergarten and first grade, or most students when they leave for the summer, and that's part of the reason why we have summer schools, et cetera. And I think that we have data that supports the fact that students that are really high-need students or students that have some potential risk factors are also students that tend to lose more over the summer. So that supporting what they've learned in high-quality preschool, between preschool and kindergarten, and then supporting and maintaining what they have learned over the summer. They are not typically the children that are doing activities, going to museums, going to vacations, going to places where they might continue to increase their vocabulary and continue to increase their reading skills. These are children that really, really can benefit from having that extra 4 weeks and boost between kindergarten and first grade as well.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no questions from members right now, I'll ask if anybody from the audience would like to testify in regards to this bill. Seeing none, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 1426 be recommended and passed and re-referred to the Committee on Finance with recommendation to re-refer to the K-12 Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
Madam Chair and members. Thank you. From everything I can see here, we are done for the evening, so meeting is adjourned.